all of you tonight. We're happy to have you here in our new facility. We've moved around a bit in the last couple of years, and thanks to Scott Root and regional staff, we situated in a brand new building here in the library, and hopefully we'll be able to take good care of it and not stay too late, and we'll be invited back again. So anyway, thanks Scott and the central staff for this wonderful facility, and we hope to continue to have our meetings here for a long time. I'd like to have the members of the RAC introduce themselves, and I'll start over on my right with Sarah.
I'm Sarah Flinders. I'm the Uinta Wasatch Cache National Forest Representative from the Spanish Fork District.
I'm Dwayne Smith, Non-Consumptive Representative.
Larry Fitzgerald, Agricultural.
Richard Hanson, at large.
Chris Martin, at large.
Jay Price, Elected Officials.
Matt Clark, Sportsman's Rep.
Carl Hurst, Sportsman Rep.
George Holmes, Agriculture.
Tim Fair, at large.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Two of our members have asked to be excused tonight. Gary Nelson may join us later, but he's asked to be excused, and Michael Gates. I'd also like to acknowledge some people here tonight. We actually have three members of the Wildlife Board. We're thrilled to have them come out and see firsthand how the RACs are operating, and especially the input we're getting from the sportsmen. So we'd like to welcome Ernie Perkins, Bill Fenimore, and John Baer. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here tonight. We appreciate it. Also like to welcome Alan Clark. Alan is the Assistant Director of the Division. He's going to be presenting later on in the program. Alan, we're happy to have you with us, as well as all of the other Division staff. Particularly, I'd like to acknowledge Amanda Bagley, who's going to be taking our minutes tonight. So I don't think I've missed anybody. Thank you all for being here. Let me quickly go through how our meeting will go. We do have, and by the way, there were minutes available at the table as you came in. If you didn't find a minute, you can go over there and pick one up. We do have five action items tonight that we'll be discussing. For each one of the agenda items, we will be asking one of the DWR staff to be making a 10 to 15 minute presentation offering some background information and proposals on that item from the division. After the end of the presentation, I'll ask the RAC members if they have any questions or clarification for the staff member, and then I will ask you as audience members, if you have any questions or clarification. If you do, I'd ask you to come up to this microphone in front, let us know who you are, and ask your question. This is not the time for you to make your presentation, but just for questions. Then once the question period is closed, we will ask for public comment. If you would like to make a comment tonight, I would like you beforehand to fill out one of these yellow comment cards. They are available up here at the front of the room. And under the area which says agenda topics, indicate which of the five topics you'd like to speak on, and you're certainly welcome to speak on more than one. If you want to speak on the first one, just put down deer, second one, bucks and bulls, third one, antlerless, fourth, CWMU, and fifth, if you want to speak on the bonus points, so that we know which topic you do want to speak on. After the question period, it will be time for you to let us know how you feel about these agenda items that we're going to be talking about tonight. And when I call your name, I'd ask you to come up to the microphone again. Let us know who you are, and if you represent an organization, let us know what that what organization that is. If you're representing an organization, I'd like you to take no more than 5 minutes to let us know how you feel about the presentation. If you're representing yourself, if you could please limit your comments to 3 minutes, that would be very much appreciated. Then after all the comments, we will come back to the members of the RAC, and we will deliberate on what we have heard tonight, make motions, and ultimately we will be making a recommendation to the Wildlife Board on what we've heard. So that's the way we will proceed, and we'll continue on then with our first item, and that is informational. We'll get a regional update from our regional coordinator, John Fairchild. John?
Thanks. I think the other acts have run quite long, and so we'll try to be brief. And I'll give an update by section and some of the programs. In our wildlife section, this is the time of year that we conduct range rides done on horseback, and that's to go through winter range areas, checking range conditions. This year, I'm sure we're not checking for mortality, but if they're out there, they would never survive any year. So there are range trend studies that we've added to that, where we'll be looking at browse utilization, pellet group transects, again, getting more familiar with how those deer herds are doing on their winter range. Spring deer classification continues. That's a check really on fawn survival. Sage-grouse select counts, those are March, April programs, and those are in progress. And on either spring deer classification or sage-grouse, if we have RAC members that have an interest in getting out, please get a hold of Craig Clyde. Deer management plans will be submitted really for a one-year extension this year, and they'll be updated after we get our range trend data that'll be taken this summer, and so we'll be updating those next year. Pronghorn flight surveys, they'll be flown on the West Desert later this month, and Tom Becker is always looking for volunteers who can hold it together on a aerial flight. Habitat range trend studies will be carried out in the central region this year, and that's with our crew out of our Ephraim Great Basin Experiment Station. In near Stockton this last weekend, sponsored by the Mule Deer Foundation, there may have been some other groups that were involved, but planted 3,400 bitterbrush seedlings on some winter range there. In our aquatic section, community fishing waters that are really popular are stocked weekly now. We're going to be conducting spring gillnet surveys on Deer Creek and Jordanelle the week of May 7th to 11th. And again, if any RAC members are interested in that, get a hold of Mike Slater. Cabela's is going to have a tagged fish contest at Utah Lake and Grantsville Reservoir. That's going to run from May 5th to July 8th. At Utah Lake, it'll involve white bass and catfish, and in Grantsville, it involves rainbows. We will do the tagging. The contest is theirs. There's also going to be a tagged fish contest at Strawberry involving rainbows. I believe 300 tagged there. Utah Lake Field Day is a day when Division of Wildlife Resources assists the Utah Lake Commission in putting on some conservation education programs for elementary school kids. Quite a few show up on 3 different days, and that'll be in this month and in May. Our native aquatic biologists are really pleased with numbers of egg masses that they're counting for a Columbia spotted frog, which is a species that is being considered for listing. And so that is really good news that at least the potential is there for increasing. Now we have to see what happens. Tiger muskie program is a success story so far. We've got our first stocking that'll take place with fish that are reared at the Lake Leakey hatchery in Salt Lake. That's the tiger muskies. It's an infertile hybrid between northern pike and muskellunge. In our conservation outreach section, carried out by this guy over here, we have a mountain goat viewing day this Saturday, and that'll be at the mouth of Little Cottonwood Canyon. Always a popular event, and we kind of take advantage of the fact we still have a few skiers going up the canyon, and I imagine that's a lot of who we see. The Utah Lake Access Guide is completed, and if you have a need to know where you can access Utah Lake for fishing or hunting, it's a real useful brochure that Scott Root put together. In our law enforcement section, we've got an aquatic invasive species roadblock that we're going to be doing later this spring on I-80 out of Wendover. We're moving a lot of those roadblocks to port of entry. They seem to be more productive. And we've got some officers going down later this month to see how it's run in Bloomington, south of St. George. For those who are interested in antlers, seems to be a big deal, but the antler sale is on May 8th, and that's at the Lee K. Center in Salt Lake. And as long as we're talking law enforcement, just pass along that on the turkey hunt, we've had some hunt unit violations. The boundary between the southeast and the central region for those limited entry permits is the Skyline Drive, and there are people that are getting confused with the old last year's region deer hunt boundaries. And other than that, unless anyone from the RAC has a question. I do need to do that. We have one of our biologists has observed what she considers to be a wolf. There's no way of knowing that it's not a wolf hybrid at this point, but there's no reason to consider that it's not a wolf either. So we're still in the mode of trying to verify what it is that has been appearing and reappearing in the Diamond Fork, Spanish Fork Canyon area. She observed that, within the last month, Craig? And she was actually going out that day to try to call and see if she could get a return off of a wolf in the Sheep Creek area, and observed it on the side of the road. Was able to pursue at least the direction that it traveled. Got a pretty good look with binoculars, and did make a call, and it eventually returned the call. So, I think we can expect, first of all, we can expect wolves to be making their way through northern Utah. We have documented. We've had reports, and this is the one that we've documented. Wildlife Services also observed several. I believe it was four from a helicopter when they were doing some aerial gunning on coyotes. And they're pretty knowledgeable about wolves, so it looked like a wolf to them, and we're just following up. Is there anything you want to add, Craig? If we are able to have one in hand, why don't you let them know what we plan to do?
Just quickly, we did bring in Wildlife Services to set up a trap. We put roadkill out to try to draw that wolf in, or hybrid. And at that point, if we could trap it, which we were not able to, we'll try to get another location now. But if we could get it in hand, what we would do is draw blood from that and do a DNA test. We cannot tell whether it was a chihuahua or a wolf, just that it's a canine. But we can tell from the DNA whether it's related to the wolves in Yellowstone, which most likely that's where it came from. And if it's not from there, then most likely it's a hybrid.
No collar, right?
And yeah, then at that point we'd put a collar on it. And then if we determined that they were hybrids, then we would go in and start taking out the wolves following those collars, and the ones with collars would be the last one shot.
I got a question. So there's a possibility there's a non-wolf species killing Utah wildlife?
Yeah, it'd be just a hybrid, which we would consider a dog, and at that point, Utah law says that any dog chasing wildlife can be shot as far as chasing big game.
So what's, you're not Palomino game. I know this is an impossible question, but you're just going to let them keep killing that wildlife until you prove it's a war.
Yeah, because right now we have to assume that it is. And so there's nothing we can do until we determine that. And we've spent days up there with a helicopter trying to get them located to where we could net gun them and haven't been able to do that. We've been trying to trap. The biologists are going out biweekly and calling, trying to get them located so that we can bring in wildlife services to set traps. It's a lot easier to do in the wintertime, and we didn't have much of a winter this year. Richard?
Is it illegal for a person to kill one of those now? I mean, you haven't determined what they are yet.
It's not illegal if it was actually in the process of chasing wildlife and it was a dog. If it was, it turns out to be a wolf, you're in big trouble. All I can say.
Thanks, Craig. Chris Marble, one of our RAC members, was actually involved with the seed planting in Stockton. Would you just take a minute, Chris, and
sure.
Talk about how many people showed up? I think we're always appreciative of when sportsmen get on the ground and do volunteer work, and I think this was one of the nice things that happened last Saturday. Just take a minute.
Sure. Out by Stockton, there was a bull hogging project where a lot of P&J was taken out. The division, along with Mule Deer Foundation, put together the project and asked the United Wildlife Cooperative to get involved. We had about 65 people show up, went out and planted some bitterbrush seedlings or some about 10-inch tall brush, and it was a great event. We expected to be out there all day, and we were done within 3 hours. We had so many people show up, but it was a lot of acres that got done for the sake of mule deer. It's a great project.
Thanks very much. I need to go back a step and ask people to approve the minutes from the last meeting that you received through email, as well as the agenda for tonight. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes and the agenda for this evening? A motion by Duane, a second by Chris. All in favor? And that passes unanimously. We'll go ahead then with our first action item, and that is talking about the deer management plan amendment and general season deer permits. And Anise Anood will be making that presentation. Anise?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, RAC members. As you mentioned, I'll be presenting the Bucks Bulls Once in a Lifetime permit numbers and rule change recommendations. We'll start out with the general season deer permit numbers and recommendations, and I'll stop there, and then we can deal with that first and then move on to the other agenda items. Okay, I always like to show some harvest data when I do this presentation, just to give people an idea, you know, what kind of numbers we're talking about when we're talking general season mule deer hunting. So basically, as you can see, this graph goes back to 2001 to last year, 2011, and harvest has varied from, you know, a low of about 18,000 to a high of about 28,000, and a lot of that varies for a lot of different reasons. You know, some of them may vary because you had fewer bucks, some may vary because weather wasn't such that you could harvest a high number of bucks, and then other high harvests are because, you know, you may have had a snow event or whatever that made the bucks more vulnerable. The last couple of years are low, basically is because we cut permits. I mean, we've cut a total of from 97,000 we're now to 87,000. So within the last couple of years, we've cut close to 10,000 permits out of our general deer season. And I'll be talking a little bit more about that as I go through my presentation. With the current recommendation, to keep in mind that those cuts have already happened. That's why it doesn't take as big of a cut in the coming years to get to where we need to go with our objectives. Okay, this graph basically shows our fawn production. So this is our fawns per 100 does post-season. This is a survey we do right after the season ends, to basically figure out how many fawns made it from 0 to 6 months of age. and then and those are the fawns per 100 does. That's a pretty big indicator of how many how our population is doing. Basically, obviously these fawns are going to either be recruited and become adults the following year or not, and that'll tell you whether your population is increasing, being stable, or declining. For most of Utah, on average, if you're above 60, if you're around or above 60 fawns per 100 does, you usually have an increasing population. Depending on what winters, but on average winters and average precip, that's kind of what it plays out to be. So as you can see with this graph, you know, we've been as high as 70 in 1998. We hit probably bottom in 2002. That was the height of the drought. Things improved slightly, and then we've seen another dip in that 07-08 when we had droughty conditions again, and things have leveled out. Still, long term, our mule deer herd is probably stable to slightly declining, which is kind of this, what this shows. Similarly, buck doe ratios actually tell you how buck harvests or how many bucks are in the field post hunt. So basically, these are our the same time of year we do our fawn doe ratios, we do our buck doe ratios, and then we manage harvest based on these numbers. So we like to under the old plan we wanted to see a minimum of 15 bucks per 100 does. That plan was amended. And is now the bottom is 18 bucks per 100 does. And that's what those two lines indicate. So the bottom line is with the old plan minimum buck doe ratio was, and then the top yellow line is what the new plan minimum buck doe ratio are. And I just put that up there so you kind of have an idea of where we were and where we need to be, and those cuts and permits are what's going to get us there. Okay, so jumping into our recommendations, the recommendation we'll be making will require a plan amendment. As I just mentioned, our plan currently, the one that was just passed before we basically went into this part of the plan, is to manage for 18 to 25 bucks per 100 does on all 30 units. Since that time, the Wildlife Board gave us direction to look at different ratios objectives on different units, and this will allow us to have a mix of units, some that may be managed for 18 to 20 or 15 to 17, that for units that lend themselves more to high harvest, it makes more sense to have a lower buck doe ratio objective because it's going to be harder to reach that 18 buck per 100 does without cutting a lot of permits. So anyway, if this mixed approach is adopted, it would require an amendment to the plan, and then approving this recommendation basically amends the plan automatically, so there doesn't need to be another process to do it. So what we did is basically the approach we took is we met internally first and said, you know, what kind of objectives do we think we want to put out there? And then we kind of came up with this two-tier system, although it wasn't as developed. And then we asked the regional folks to take that back out and find out what the public thought of it. And I don't know how many of you were involved, but we had a lot of open houses throughout the state kind of gaining that kind of information to see where we wanted to be. So what we decided on, given all that information, is we wanted a two-tier system, basically, where some units in the state would be managed for 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does post-season, and some units would be managed for 18 to 20 bucks per 100 does. So the next thing we needed to figure out is, you know, how do we assign which unit gets what objective? So we came up with some criteria that made sense, at least from the harvest side of things. So units that are that have good access and lend themselves to high harvest would require a greater cut to get to 18 bucks per 100 does. So we recommended those be in the 15 to 17 buck per 100 does range. So we recommended units with good access and are primarily public land be managed for 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does. Inversely, we recommended units that have limited access. These do not have to be private lands, but maybe wilderness areas, those type of things, or have a large proportion of private land be managed for the 18-20 bucks per 100 does postseason. And the rationale behind that is those units would likely not have high harvest, even if you had a large number of permits, so you could offer more opportunity without reducing buck doe ratio on those units. Now, if you just applied those objectives directly to the units, you actually would end up with more units with 15 to 17 bucks per 100 does objective than 18 to 20, and we did that exercise internally. But we also asked the regions, again, to feel the pulse of their constituents in the regions to see where it would be, and then we actually modified those based on that input from the regions. So even though some of these units would fit very well in the 15 to 17 buck per 100 doe objective, they were raised to the 18 to 20 because that's what the public in that area wanted. So the final number, given our internal, you know, back and forth, and then gathering input from the public, we came up with 16 units that were assigned 18 to 20 objective, and then 14 units that were assigned 15 to 17 objective. Okay, now the next step is how do you set permits on these units? First we needed to get a starting point. So how many hunters, you know, hunted these units in the past that got us the current buck-to-doe ratios on these units? And to get to that number, we found the best approach is to actually get the actual buck harvest on each of these units and then apply the success rate on these units to get to the number of permits. We trust our harvest data a lot better than our permit data just because we get that through a harvest survey. So doing that, we basically came up with a starting number based on the harvest on those units, applying the success rate, and then applying the number of hunters that actually buy a tag and don't hunt. It varies, but it's about 13 to 15% of hunters actually buy a tag and don't go hunting. So given that, it gave us the starting number of permits, and then from that, we increase or decrease permits based on a three-year buck doe average. And we used a formula to increase and decrease permits based on 10 years of data, looking at all at harvest at all different buck doe ratio regimes. So, you know, for those of you who are not familiar with it, as you increase buck doe ratio, actually success rate rises. So you have to actually issue fewer and fewer permits to catch up with that. So we built that graph and made the formula that's needed to let us figure out if we're managing for 18 to 20, how many permits would we need given a certain population on that on those units. And then we also, in setting those initial permits, basically set a target of the middle of the range on those objectives. So if we're managing for 15 to 17, we calculated for 16 bucks per 100 does. And similarly, in the 18 to 20 range, we calculated for 19 bucks per 100 does. So we want to be in the middle of the range, not in the bottom end. And then we also set some restrictions on ourselves. So units that were above 17 or were above 20, we limited our increase to 10% because we wanted to be on the conservative side. Now, units that required a cut, we cut as much as needed, as many permits as needed to get to objective as quickly as possible. So we limited ourselves on increasing permits, but we did not limit ourselves on decreasing permits. Okay, I'm not going to go through these one by one, but that's basically how these played out. You should have all this in your packet. But basically, units were, you know, these are in alphabetical order and in order of 18 to 20 first and then 15 to 17 second. So obviously we've got all 30 units in there. Then I'll show you what the summary is. Now, if the amendments to have two objectives as we're presenting here tonight is not adopted, we can revert to this plan as it exists that every unit would be 18 to 25. So that's an option, and I'll tell you the permits under each scenario. Okay, so if we're recommending basically what I mentioned, that 16 units would be managed for 18 to 17 and 14 units 15 to 17, this would be the permit recommendation. So basically there would be 17,300 archery permits. 51,900 rifle permits and 17,300 muzzleloader permits for a total of 86,500. Now, that's only a 500 permit reduction from last year, but remember, we were already 10,000 below the cap. We cut 7,000 permits alone last year. Another thing that you need to keep in mind is we changed the splits on the weapon types, which actually we were able to issue more permits because of that as well. So what we did is we took all the permits and then put a 60-20-20 split. So 60% go to rifle hunters, and then 20% go to archery and muzzleloader hunters. Through our hunter surveys, we found that hunters were willing to move permits into less successful weapon types in order to gain permits, and we did that. This is the same split we use for our limited entry and have always used for our limited entry. And it kind of gives advantage a little bit to the archery and muzzleloaders for permits, but it's not so far out of whack that rifle hunters are not able to get a tag. So it does a couple of things. So if the recommended unit objectives are modified, so if like one or two units are moved from one to the other, the total permit numbers will have to be modified, and we do have calculations that we can make to do that if needed. Okay, now, if the proposed objective mix is not adopted, as I mentioned, we can go back to the plan as it exists, 18 to 25, and then the total number of permits would be 80,200. Roughly the same number of archery permits as last year, about a 10,000 permit reduction in rifle permits, and about a 3,000 increase in muzzleloader permits. So that would be roughly a 6,000 permit reduction from the mixed or the hybrid approach that we recommend. Okay, so another thing we had to deal with when we went to unit by unit and broke things by weapon type, especially archery, now that they have to hunt on a unit by unit basis. When we ran the numbers, we realized there would be some units where permits would be available after the drawing, and most of these permits would likely be archery and muzzleloader permits. To avoid loss of opportunity and revenue, we recommend the remaining permits, archery permits, become available as muzzleloader permits on September 17th. So this is after the archery season ends. So archers can still buy those permits as archery permits throughout the season until the archery season ends. And the reason we did that is it's going to incentivize archers to buy them during the archery season, specifically those archers that want to hunt the extended area. Because once the archery season ends, if they want to hunt the extended archery areas, they won't be able to buy them. So we're hoping to sell them all as archery permits, but if they don't sell, they will roll over and become muzzleloader permits. And similarly, if they remain after the muzzleloader season ends, if any remaining permits exist, they would become any weapon permits at that time. This will be on very few units, and we don't expect a lot of permits to go that route, but there's a built-in mechanism to deal with that on a unit-by-unit basis, because if harvest success rises slightly, you will see that in the buck-to-doe ratio, and you can adjust permits on the unit as a whole, given those permit splits. So it's kind of a built-in fix for itself. If you do have a little bit higher success, you can set the permits differently on a three-year average. And that's the general season recommendations. I thank you, and I'd be glad to take any questions if you have.
Thank you, Anise. Questions or clarification from RAC members to Anise? Duane, and then Richard.
You said that you commented that archery and muzzleloader were less opportunity to be successful. It wasn't, in fact, the muzzleloader harvest percentage as high as rifle loader harvest percentage this last year?
It can be as high. Usually it's about 1 or 2, sometimes 5% lower, but it can be. When you look at a statewide basis, it kind of washes out, but on a unit by unit basis, for the most part, they're kind of a little bit lower. Yeah, it's almost equal, but it's
kept going up and up and up and up as they become less and less and less primitive weapons.
Sure.
And so
yeah,
I'm a little concerned that we continue to give them priority in terms of hunting opportunity, in terms of being there early when.
Yeah, and we thought about that.
You've increased the permits for.
Sure. And we thought about that as well, but the way we thought about it is we're taking away from rifle hunters. If we put it in muzzleloader, we're not going to shoot more bucks, but there is a chance we could shoot less. So it gives those rifle hunters that may not be archers an opportunity to hunt a similar weapon type without, you know, feeling left out of the game.
You mean if they switch to muzzleloader?
Right.
I've never had so many complaints as I had last year from rifle hunters. And then when they saw the percentages that were equal, mm-hmm. I was deluged with comments.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to make it even worse, where you've given more permits to muzzleloaders and fewer to rifle people.
Well, in the past, there was no split. In the past, they came out of the same pool. So they were proportioned to how many people put into the weapon type. So,
well, I just looked at the numbers you had up there.
Mm-hmm.
I know
that's how they played out. You're talking last year's number? Yeah, it was about 13,000. And that's proportional to how many people actually applied for those weapon types. So it's that one is almost straight as supply-demand.
But you're going to increase that number and reduce rifle numbers.
Correct.
I don't see that.
Richard.
Anise, we decided on how many permits you would give for each unit. Did you use the data, you know, when we get these calls and say, how many days did you hunt in this area, and where did you hunt, and blah, blah, blah. Was that, when you did that, some hunters were going to say, well, okay, I hunted on the Nebo on 2 days, and then I hunted on the West Desert for 2 days. Does that still count as a hunter on each unit?
No. But as I mentioned, we don't trust that information as much as the harvest. What we took is how many bucks were harvested on each unit, applied success rate, and then that's how we got the permit numbers. So we did not take the number as you mentioned it, because that number gives you a higher number because they can hunt multiple units. We did not go that route, knowing full well that overestimates the number of hunters.
Okay. The other question I have is when you made that determination of tag numbers, permit numbers, did you take into consideration the size of the unit and the crowding issue?
On some units, we did. Obviously, if it's a public land unit and it was general season, usually hunters are you know, avoid crowding. So we took that into consideration. Where we did take it into consideration is on units that are primarily private land or have a lot of private land. We actually didn't increase permits on those units at all, knowing that access would be an issue.
I was just looking at some of the numbers, and the one I'm familiar with, there's a lot of permits on that unit.
Yeah.
I'll bet you that's probably 20% higher number of hunters will be on that unit than has normally been on that unit, because they can't go anywhere else.
Yeah. I guess I would disagree with you there. Actually, if we would have taken the long-term average, it would have actually been a higher number. The reason it was lower because the last 3 years we've been cutting permits. So I feel it's a conservative number, to be honest.
Okay, well, I guess we'll see. I just think that the guys know where the deer are, and they're all going to go there.
Yeah.
And even though the unit's as big as it is, you know, it's kind of...
Sure.
They're not going to go where the deer aren't, so you're going to have hunters just concentrated. In
yeah. And if that's the case, you know, it's a fluid plan. We can change permit numbers from year to year. So we'll kind of see and watch it.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions from Rack? Tim?
So you put a lot of work into generating all of the numbers and everything like that. Have you seen anything in the survivability or other things that are going on that would... in your mind, question any of the numbers that you have out there?
No, because all the numbers we have here are based on harvest information. So if anything, survival this year is higher, and hopefully in the next few years we'll be able to issue more permits once we get the buck-to-doe ratios. Because buck-to-doe ratios post-hunt really track the populations well. So if anything, we're on the conservative side because we're dealing with where we've set permits on the populations when they were fairly low. So if they do increase, you know, we should see more bucks, not fewer.
Thanks. Carl?
With all the different factors you have to figure in on a 15 to 17 and an 18 to 20, do you have a guess on how many permits you could add moving one from 18 to 20 or versus moving one from 15 to 17?
Oh, yeah, we've done all the calculations. And I think there is a list in your packet that actually doesn't each at one at 15 to 17, 18 to 20. And
I just kind of wanted, is it a 3% or a 5% or some guess like that?
It's not that simple. It's a calculation that it creates a slope because as you add the objective, as you increase the objective, success rate goes up, so you harvest more. So it's not a linear thing, so you can't say it's just a straight percentage. And each unit is a little bit different, so it depends where you're coming from, how many permits you already have, and where you need to get to. So some units, it's a small number of permits and a small percentage. Some it's not, depending on where the curve is, where on the curve you are when you're starting. It's a bit complex to explain, but it took a lot of work to actually figure it out. And we do have a sliding scale where we can say, if we want to manage for this, we need this many permits given this population.
Carl, and the rest of you, in your revised agenda, on the back of page 2 is where those numbers are, yeah, if you haven't looked at them already. Other questions?
And do you have a feeling for which of these scenarios, of 15 to 17 or 18 to 20, is going to grow a deer herd quicker or less?
To be honest, I mean, if I were managing the deer herd, I would manage for the lowest because you want to remove as many bucks as possible while having enough to breed the does. But that's not what we're doing. We're managing for how many bucks hunters want to see in the field. So, you know, both will grow the herd at a probably an equal rate. I mean, the more bucks you carry, the more there's going to be interaction between bucks and does when they get to those stressful periods.
Other questions? Chris.
Going back to Wayne's point on the 60-20-20 split, can you kind of talk about where that came from?
So basically, it optimizes the number of permits you can have without going. I mean, really, if you want to optimize, you would put 25% or maybe even 30% into archery, about 15 into muzzleloader and the rest rifle. But so what we looked at is how many apply. And how many, you know, so it was kind of an optimization thing. So most people would feel they got an opportunity to get a tag, and we can issue as many permits as possible.
So the only way to reduce a muzzleloader tag allotment on a unit is reduce the total number of tags, right?
Or move them into rifle. Either way, you're going to kill the same number of bucks.
But you're not set on a 60-20-20 split. That's just
that would be our preferred way to go, because we've done a lot of calculations. That would be the best.
So you've applied that statewide and everything, yeah, like 60-20-20.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, if we do change it, we want it to stay statewide, because the way they do the drawing, they can't draw different units at different percentages.
Okay, thank you.
One more question, Ace.
Sure.
On some units, the herd objective is, you know, some up's only 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming, okay, that herd objective is, you know, habitat-wise is reasonable and realistic, does it really hurt to have a high number of bucks compared to number of does? Are they really competing with each other and the fawns even in that situation, or do they just move and go where the feed is?
Yeah. So your assumption is that resources are never limiting, which is never the case for any wildlife species.
So
they're always limiting on some portion of their range. So the way we set our objectives is really not based on habitat limitations, to be honest. It was set on back when on harvest that was on those units, and they backed into a number of how many deer they could have. So again, I feel most units are limited in one way or the other, whether they're summer range limited or winter range limited or in some way. Otherwise, those populations would be, you know, growing at this rate, not at this rate.
Okay. But if I know we're trying to manage this so that we have more bucks,
mm-hmm.
okay? But ultimately, though, there's got to be a big factor in there that it isn't detrimental to the actual increase or growth of the herds if that particular area can
sure.
withstand it, habitat-wise, right?
Sure, that's correct.
So if that's not, I mean, that's got to be a really big part of this. That's why I'm saying if the objective, you know, what the handle that unit can actually handle habitat-wise is really low. I don't see how the bucks would really be detrimental to the survivor of the fawns or the does in a normal winter situation.
Sure. You're correct on that. It does not harm anything. What it does harm is the number of hunters you can put on that unit. So you have to cut permits. Yeah, I mean, on most normal winters when things are not limiting, having 30, 40 bucks per 100 does doesn't hurt anything. There has been studies showing if you get above 40 bucks per 100 does, you do start seeing a decline in fawn doe ratios. I don't know exactly what the mechanism, I'm assuming it's competition, but and these are studies that were done in Colorado on units where they have 40 plus bucks per 100 does, and they actually saw a decline in their fawn doe ratios on those units. So you want to manage between 10 and 40, and anywhere in between there will work, depending on how many hunters you want to put on a unit. Obviously, if you want to maximize the number of hunters, you want to manage towards the lower end of that. If you want to maximize the number of big bucks, you'll manage towards the high end of that. So anywhere in the middle will work. It's just what you're, the, you know, the, is how many hunters do you want on that unit.
Okay. So on some units that the objective that it can really realistically carry, okay, if that's, you know, way below the harvest or the objective, the population objective, a higher buck doe ratio wouldn't hurt it until that herd begins to grow. And then you get into that situation where there's too many, you're not going to grow the herds, right? So then can you drop the buck doe ratio down for that unit, you know, after a few years and help
yeah.
take some of them bucks out so they're not competing
yeah.
for that same
increase. I see where you're getting at. So if a population is not growing, resources are limited. So that's you have to make that assumption. If the population, no matter what the objective is, the objective could be way off, I guess is what I'm saying. If the population is not growing, resources are limited. There's a reason they're not producing young. There's a reason they're more apt to get predated upon. There's a lot of things, and it usually leads back to the resource, habitat. Is there cover? Is there enough forage? Is there anything? So in almost all of our units, we're not growing. So there's on all of our units, we don't need more bucks, I guess is what I'm saying. I mean, we've got 36 bucks per 100 does on the book lifts, yet we're at 30 fawns per 100 does. So, you know, having more bucks doesn't grow you does, but we know, doesn't grow you fawns, but we know having fewer will release that much habitat for the does to reproduce. So I don't see any, really very few units in the state where we're not limited by habitat, no matter where the objective is. Please understand that these objectives are fairly arbitrary. They're not based on carrying capacity.
So really what you're really saying is that we're at our max. In this state, we're at our max.
Some years we'll be at our max. Some years when we get a little more precip, we actually grow more forage, we will increase. But on the average, we are. I mean, if you look at the way the populations have been for the last 15 years, they've been right around that 300,000 mark. Unless we can improve habitat and continue to improve habitat, I don't think we can grow mule deer anymore.
So basically, we're throwing millions of dollars away.
No, we're throwing millions of dollars
gonna,
on habitat to improve
fund,
it.
You know, taking predators out more, trying to release some pressure there mm-hmm. on the animals and things like that. That's really not what, I mean, we can't expect maybe 1 or 2% growth out of that.
Predator control will help, But it can only help to a certain degree if your resources are limited. Yeah, I think you need to try all the tools in the toolbox to see, to make sure that that's what's going on. And we're not saying this blindly. There's been tons of studies done in the West looking at predator control, habitat, and every other aspect of mortality, and it always comes back to habitat. And having good habitat actually could reduce predation. Because cover is there, the fawns can hide for the first couple of weeks. There's a lot of different aspects to habitat that can to mitigate predation. So even having poor habitat, if you do predator control, you could boost the population slightly. But in the long run, you have to have better habitat, or else you're not going to grow.
Richard, we need to move on here. Thank you. You have a question? Susan?
So why are we not basing the recommendations on carrying capacity?
Because carrying capacity is almost impossible to measure because it varies widely from year to year. And you can't. There is no such thing as an average year, neither no weather nor, anything like that. So what we use is buck doe ratios because it tracks populations so closely. So if you have a population of 10 and you remove this many bucks, it's going to be reflected in your buck-to-doe ratio. So no matter what the population is, if the population is declining and you over-harvest, your buck-to-doe ratio will drop. It's the best measure of a population without actually knowing how many you have. Does that make sense?
And my true question was, on the one chart where you showed the units that are going to be recommended for 15 to 17, the ratio, it was really fast, so I didn't get a look at it very closely.
Sure.
But
I could go back to any of those.
No, that's okay. I noticed, though, there were several units in there that were actually at 13 and maybe a couple below. So They're not even at objective to meet the 15 to 17 ratio. Why are those units still in the 15 to 17 ratio and not bumped up to the 18 to 20 until they actually meet objective and then be bumped down? Why are we? They're already under objective. What's the reasoning behind keeping them in this objective where they're not going to even possibly meet the 15 to 17 ratio
Sure.
and not bump them up until they recover and then drop it back down?
Yeah. So these units are units that lend themselves to high harvest. That's why their buck-to-doe ratios are low. So once you start managing for a higher buck-to-doe ratio than they currently have, you cut permits that much to get to 15 to 17. You don't need to bump them up to get to 18, then bring them back down. Just by setting the permits needed on that unit to get to 16, automatically you'll get to 16. So we're reducing numbers of permits on those units to get to the objective. So even though they were 13, it doesn't mean we have the same number of permits. We've cut permits by X percent, and I think that information is in your packet, to get to 16 bucks per 100 does. So on some of these units, we've cut 25% of the tags to get from 13 to 16. So we've made the cuts required to get to 16, because to get to 18, you have to cut that much more. And really, those units do not lend themselves to low harvest just because the deer are more susceptible to harvest. But by cutting permits, you're able to get to 16, and that's where those units should be because you're trying to maximize opportunity.
Larry, a question? Okay. We'll move on then to the audience. Audience members, if you have questions for Anise, this is the time to ask questions or clarification. Later on, we'll ask you for your comment period. But if you have a question, come on up to this microphone, let us know who you are, and ask your question.
Glad you didn't sit down. Ty Bolter. Anise, I have a couple questions. One is if... I'm speaking facetious here, but I'm sure you might have an idea. If we move to, say, a statewide 25 to 100 buck-to-doe ratio, what can we expect as far as population adjustments? Will it go up? Will it go down? Will it stay the same? What are we looking at?
You're talking permits or populations? Mm-hmm. So permits...
No. Actually, I'm talking deer populations.
Deer populations.
Yeah.
Likely, it would be fairly similar. You would add, the few bucks that survive. So you may add, 5,000 bucks that wouldn't be harvested to the population, so it would boost it by 5,000.
So we don't have an issue with deer density and does getting bred because of low deer density?
No. That's all that always comes up as far as numbers of bucks needed to breed populations. There's been studies that show you can get down to 5 or 6 bucks per 100 does and still have 98% pregnancy rates. A good example of that is the Monroe unit is at 11 bucks per 100 does, and we recently did a capture to do a fawn study, and 69 does captured, 68 were pregnant.
Okay, that kind of segues into my next question. What do fawn recruitment and fawn to doe ratios look like across the board, say in high buck to doe ratio units compared to low buck to doe ratio units? Do we have lower fawn to doe recruitment in those lower buck to doe ratio units?
No, we don't. So it varies. Like I mentioned, you could have the range anywhere. So we have units that have, 11 bucks per 100 does, yet they produce maybe 60 fawns per 100. We have units where we have 30, 36 bucks per 100 does, and they're producing 30 fawns. So the number of bucks doesn't seem to be directly tied to reproduction unless you fall below 10 or you're above 40.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions from the audience? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the question time. Open it up to your comments. If you have a comment card and you haven't brought it up yet, this is the time to let me have it. Thank you. Other comment cards? Thank you. Thank you, sir. Okay, remember, if you are representing yourself, we'd like you to limit your comments to 3 minutes. If you're representing an organization, let us know who that is. And please take no more than 5 minutes. Ben Lauder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ben Lauder. I'm here representing the Utah Bowman's Association tonight. First of all, I'd like to thank you guys for the opportunity to be here to comment and for the service that you guys are providing here tonight as the RAC. Next, I'd like to applaud the division on this recommendation that they've come up with here. Over the last year or so, one thing that I've noticed is we were discussing whether or not to go to the 29-30 unit deal. My personal observation, and I think most people have seen this, is the public is really split about 50-50 on whether they want a low buck-to-doe ratio or high buck-to-doe ratio, more opportunity versus more quality. And we've seen this even within individual organizations. So I really feel that what the division has come up with here, with 14 in one objective, 16 in the other, we're at about that 50% ratio to really appease both sides of the public opinion. That said, Utah Bowman's Association supports the division's recommendations as presented. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ben. Mike Christensen.
It's Mike Christensen, just representing myself. I just want to give the RAC just a kind of a brief overview of how we came to 15 to 25 buck to doe ratio objective that we currently have. I sat as a member on the Mule Deer Committee in 2008 when we rewrote the management plan, and there was a lot of discussion on whether to maintain regional hunting or go to unit management, hunter management. What we ended up doing as a committee is we ended up recommending that we maintain regional hunter management. But to do that, we bumped the buck to doe ratio. It used to be at 15 to 20 per region, and what we did is we bumped that buck to doe ratio up to 25. And what that essentially did was that alleviated any concerns of if there was a couple units within the region that would maybe have some exponential growth for some reason, great habitat or predator control or something like that, that those units that had high buck to doe ratios couldn't pull the whole region's buck-to-doe ratio above 20, which would then increase permits. So the only way we could have ever reached 25 is if our deer herd was just exploding. And then that's put smiles on everybody's face. So now that we've gone to unit management, there's no reason to have that 25 number. And I would encourage the RAC, whatever you come to, that you come to a buck-to-doe ratio somewhere between that 15 to 20 number. So, you know, to maintain a region or a unit as a 20 to 25, which has been talked about in some RACs, that essentially becomes a limited entry hunt, because to maintain that high of a number of bucks, you have to cut hunters back extremely. So, you know, because the more bucks you're carrying, the higher hunter success rate, the more deer they kill. Just like Anise talked about, it's not a level plane, it's a curve. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about making a unit in the central region in that higher buck-to-doe ratio. And if the RAC was willing to do that, I'll let you guys hash that out. But that necessarily wouldn't be a horrible thing, you know. But I just wanted to go along with the division's recommendations and just give you a brief overview on how that 25 number came to be and why it's too high.
Thank you, Mike. Kim Hansen.
Hi, thank you. I'm Kim Hansen, Utah Wildlife Alliance. I'd just like to say thank you for letting us be here and express our thoughts and opinions. That's why this thing works so well. We do appreciate that. Thank you for your service. One of the things that I thought, once we decided to allow 29, 30, 31 units, how many ever we finally decided on, is it'll give us a chance to really do some serious research and find out why our deer numbers have dwindled. I have my own opinions. I've done quite a lot of research, but I think if we're not in agreement with why the deer numbers are down, let's take a few of those units. Let's make a few of them deer only. Let's make a few of them elk only. Let's make a few of them absolutely no predators only. Let's see what happens. Otherwise, this thing's just to divide up into bigger or smaller units and bigger hassle for the division to keep tabs on and everything. And, you know, and we look at the numbers on the predators and how they damage the deer herds. Back in the 1800s, there were hardly any deer around. The predators were way high. But back towards the 1900s, they started putting the bounties on the predators. You start looking at the way the numbers of deer come back. The deer came back tremendously fast. And I think we could do the same thing right now if we start looking at putting the predators in check. I know we've got a lot of effort going towards the coyotes and whatnot, but I think the cats are really doing a big damage to the deer population. Nobody seems to know exactly how many cougars we have here in Utah, but the numbers that I've heard are somewhere between 2,000 and 6,000 cougars. Now, if we use a lower number, say there's 2,000 cougars in the state, well, 52 deer a year, one a week, which is what is commonly said that they kill, we're losing a lot of deer. That's 104,000 deer every year that are killed by cougars. And if we went ahead and took 1,000 cougars off the range, we would save 52,000 deer. 52,000 deer, if you start running the numbers on that, at $45 a tag, we're going to generate approximately $4.8 million right there just by bringing those amount of deer back. Now, in the 1960s, the state harvested around 130,000 to 150,000 head of deer. We had several hundred thousand hunters out. And it was a heyday. It was a great time to hunt deer. And now we harvest around 20,000 deer in the state of Utah, and it's just appalling that that's where we're at. If we look at the San Juan Elk Ridge, back again in the heyday of the deer hunting, that area alone harvested approximately, they harvested approximately 25,000 deer off of just the San Juan Elk Ridge unit. That's a lot of deer. That meant there were about 80,000 hunters just hunting down there in the Monticello, San Juan, Blanding, Bluff area. Now, after it was closed for 5 years in 1980, No new roads, no new Walmarts, no new subdivisions, nothing going on that's any different except the predators down there. It's a premium unit. How many tags have we got down there? 43 tags is all that is issued in that whole big unit. So my proposal is that we look seriously at the cats. Of course, we probably all heard about the Arizona study, the three-bar study, where they take and they fenced off about 1 square mile, 602 acres. And what they did is they wanted to see what the difference was between the deer inside the enclosure that had no predation on them and the deer outside. Now, the numbers were appallingly greater inside. I mean, the deer, they especially focused on the drought. In 2002, they had like the worst drought they've ever had in Arizona. And inside the enclosure, there were 100 fawns per 100 does. Outside the enclosure, 18 fawns per 100 does. So the only difference is predators. And I'd really like to see us take some of these units that we've got, divide it up, and let's let the hunters help the fish and game out. Let's get rid of some predators. Let's issue more tags. Let's make the tags available for us if we want to shoot a deer, a cougar, or a bear, just like Idaho does. Let us use one tag for any one of those. It's a great idea. I think the value of a deer is way a lot more higher than it is for a value of a cougar. We all love cougars and everything, but we love deer too. And I appreciate your time, and thank you for letting me say a few words there.
Thank you, Kim. Craig Bonham.
Craig Bonham from Draper, Utah. I started hunting when I was 5 years old. My dad had enough courage to take me out in the mountains, and I'm 62, so I've hunted minus 2 years. I've hunted 55 years, and I've seen a lot of change happen in Utah. At first, the whole state of Utah was like the Henry Mountains are today, with that same kind of deer. And I guess I long for the good old days. Pretty soon there started to be so many people out hunting that it reminded me of Little Sahara on a holiday weekend. And I'm encouraged by the way things have started changing in the last few years, with more to micromanaging the deer herds and the elk herds. I see a lot of improvement that way, and I see some improvement with the recommendations that have been given here tonight. But I still think that there needs to be a lot more that needs to happen. I question, with the margin of error on surveying, if between 15 and 18 bucks per 100 does, if that margin of error is more than that. I think they're doing too little that way. I'm all for higher buck to doe ratios, fewer permits, higher tag costs. I think you'll find that the people that really appreciate the resource are willing to pay more, and they'll take better care of the environment. I would think that if we could be a little more creative in how we structure our permits. For example, Wyoming has for their deer tags, they have a special tag that costs about $600, and they have a regular tag that costs about $300. And that kind of gives somebody who it means more to get better odds at drawing a tag if they really want it, to spend the more money to do that. I'm concerned with our deer herds because the management, because if you look at our elk herds, there's 23 premium limited entry elk units. We've only got 3 deer units, and one of those is animal pilot, which really doesn't count. I'm all for the higher buck to doe ratios, even if it means fewer people hunting, increase in tag costs. And there's nothing like going out, backpacking, getting out in the woods, and in a week maybe see one or two other people and have a great experience. And I'm finding that in Colorado. I'm finding that in Nevada. And I'm finding that, well, I was finding that in Wyoming. And they're finding some challenges like Utah did in the 70s. And I hope that Wyoming gets it right with the changes that they're trying to make. But that's my perception of the management plan we've got. Thanks.
Thanks, Craig. Michael Anderson.
Good evening, folks. I'm Michael Anderson, speaking to you tonight on behalf of the United Wildlife Cooperative. And I was also a member of the Mule Deer Committee back in 2008. We worked long and hard for a long summer to put together the 2008 Mule Deer Management Plan. I never had any clue back then that here in 2012 we'd still be formulating the Mule Deer Management Plan. We'd better hurry because we've got one more year before it expires. Since we have decided to go with units, we believe that would be the way to go. Let's go with units. I think that implies a paradigm shift, a different way of thinking for most Utahns. This is brand new stuff here in Utah. And given that reality, it's doubtful we're going to get things perfect the first time around. But we do want to applaud the extraordinary efforts made by the Division of Wildlife Resources in gaining public input, putting together sound scientific data, and coming up with a reasonable formula to come up with our first round of unit permit recommendations. It's really quite impressive. As the United Wildlife Cooperative has looked at this process and taken a keen interest in this, in fact, we generated our own numbers prior to the release of the DWR recommendations and came up with something very similar to what the DWR proposes. And as we look at this, there is one major concern that has come out of all of this discussion of deer. And if you spend much time on internet forums, if you've attended the open houses, you've witnessed the fact that there is this growing tension between different factions of deer hunters as though they were different religions or races. Bow hunters, rifle hunters, and muzzleloader hunters. We've even heard that kind of divisive discussion or divisive terminology used here tonight. And I want to remind the RAC, as I've done every time I've talked to you guys, once again, we're talking about tools of management when we're talking about these weapons. We're not talking about classes of people. And if we're going to manage wildlife, then it only behooves us to use the proper tools and not get confused between the tools and the actual people who use that. Because after it's all said and done, a hunter is a hunter. He is not defined by the weapon he chooses to use on a particular hunt. With that said, we of the United Wildlife Cooperative want to totally accept the Division of Wildlife Resource recommendations as they are, and give our gratitude again for their extraordinary work in putting these recommendations together. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Dave Woodhouse.
Dave Woodhouse, here representing Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. I'd like to thank you guys for taking your time to come here tonight and to listen to everybody and put a plan together. You know, as I looked through and we discussed in our meetings the 15 to 17 ratio, 18 to 20, the 18 to 25 ratio, you know, like Mike was saying, the 25 is a super high number. It's going to be hard to reach, and it's going to be very limiting on the ability to manage, you know. And so, you know, the 18 to 20, 15 to 17, much better numbers to manage to, for the division to handle and to, you know, to manage the number of hunters on. One thing I noticed going through also was in the central region here, there's not one unit picked to be an 18 to 20 in the division's recommendation. And, you know, if you look at the Manti unit, I do believe the Southeast RAC voted to have that go to 18 to 20. And, you know, that would cut off of the recommendation of tags about 1,300 overall. If you did the Manti, about a 600 overall tag cut from the division's recommendation if you pushed the Manti to an 18 to 20. You know, and those two units are down at $13 per $100 right now, over a three-year average. The Oker Stansbury you'd lose about 300 tags if you made that an 18 to 20 unit. The Wasatch West would be a cut of 800 tags. One nice thing about the Wasatch West unit, it's at $19, just over $19 per 100 dose. So you wouldn't have to make adjustments to that unit. If it continues to grow, you know, if we could put that one into the 18 to 20 classification, it's there, it would work, and we could have a, you know, a higher unit around here. I see no reason why the West Desert West shouldn't go to the 18 to 20. They really don't know how many bucks are out there right now. But, you know, they're saying, you know, this number from the division is saying 700 tags, no cut, nothing. So, you know, I think that would be a nice one to use. And even the West Desert Tinnick, a cut of 200 tags. Not the highest demand units, you know, the Vernon's out there inside of that area, but it would be nice based on the West Desert out there to have some, you know, to push that up there. You know, so I would like for the RAC to address those, that discussion there, and, you know, let's see an 18 to 20 unit here within the central region. I don't think it's too big of a stretch. You know, like say the Wasatch West is already there. There is a tag cut. I'm not a big super fan of cutting a lot of tags. I pushed for them in the past. You guys know for a long time I pushed for 5-day hunts, everything. Right now, with SFW, the amount of effort we're putting into habitat, and we have for the past 15 years, there's a lot of habitat that's not being used in this state. Now we're making a very strong, hard push on the predators. We're going to get the predators under control. And as best we can, you know, with the tools that we can use, we're limited in the tools compared to what we had in the past. We know for a fact, you know, and he said, you know, like on the Monroe, those 16-8 does were all bred. Everyone they checked was pregnant. But one thing we do know, come fall, there's only going to be about 30 fawns with those does. Half of those does are probably carrying twins. They're being cleaned up by the predators. Then come springtime, there's even less of them left. So that's why our deer herds are going down. It's not habitat. We have the habitat to hold more animals. We have predators taking them from us. And we're going to do that. But at the same time, let's use the management tools that we do have in front of us, and let's have some quality along with the opportunity. Okay, I haven't had one person come up to me and say, you got to get us more tags. I need a tag every year. All I hear is, I took my kids out. They didn't see deer. It wasn't bucks. They didn't see deer. We have a deer problem. We don't have a buck problem. Yeah, I'd love to see. I mean, you go down on the Henry Mountains, what do you see? Deer everywhere. Bucks, does, fawns. You see them. You go on the Nebo, you don't see them. The Nebo has what? 11,000 head of deer on it, according to the division's numbers? The Henry's has 1,500. You go take the drive, it doesn't add up. Cover the same amount of territory, you're looking at similar habitat, wide open, you look at the burns on the Nebo, everything. They're not there. They are, you know. So we've got a lot of work to do to get these deer herds where they need to be. And we're going to do it. It's going to take a lot of work. And I know the division's, you know, excited with some of the programs we've got coming online with predator control. And so I'd just like to let you know, that we appreciate what you guys are doing because you're a big part of this. And I'm starting to get really nervous, so I'm going to end it. But please do look at these units within the central region, and let's try to get one of them or two up to the 18 to 20. It's not that big of an overall cut out of the tag numbers as recommended in the division's recommendation. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Dave. Steve Jones.
My name is Steve Jones. I'm from West Jordan. I've been told that you want to hear from guys like me. I don't represent anybody but myself. And the part that frustrates me more than anything is I'm in my 50s, I know what it's like to hunt in Utah in the heyday. But I also have watched the trend. And I hunt probably one of the highest pressure units in the state of Utah. You don't hear me complaining about the number of bucks that I see. I'm overweight. I'm not hiking 50 miles into some place. I'm taking my family and having a good time. And some of these comments about shoving our limits up there just don't make sense to me. We cut in 1994-95, we cut over 100,000 hunters from the state of Utah. That's been over 20-something years. And this is the best we got? The buck numbers are not the problem. Our problem is our fawns and our does. The DWR alludes to it, talks about it, talks about our habitat, but yet we keep coming back and thinking our miracle solution is cutting people out of hunting for bucks. You know what? There's big bucks on the mountain. They're there. Yeah, we have to work a little harder. So what? It's hunting. Right now, I can swallow the bitter pill of what we've now recommended to do, including the unit-by-unit hunting. But I strongly recommend that we follow what the DWR has put together. They have put together a phenomenal package, even better than I was reading on the internet. And I think they should be commended for it. And I think we should give it a chance to work instead of moaning and groaning and seeing how we can shove groups from 15 to 17 or 20 to 25. If it really doesn't make that much difference, why are we even talking about it? It doesn't add up. Let's just follow the recommendations, then see where it goes in 3 years, and then slowly start making a change. I thank you for your time, and I thank you for the DWR's effort.
Thank you, Steve. Ty, how do you pronounce your last name, Ty?
Bolter.
Bolter, thank you.
I agree with Steve and agree with Dave. We have a deer problem. We don't have a buck problem. And I've stood up here a bunch of times, and a lot of other people have too, saying, hey, let's grow more deer, because with that comes more bucks. You know, through all of this, I watch the public come up. Some are very gracious. Some are not so nice. And I just want to express my gratitude to the division for the job they do. They are the ultimate stewards of our wildlife. They are the ones that know what is going on out there, and they know what we need to do to grow more deer. So I'd like to recommend that we listen to them. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I don't have any more comment cards. Anybody else in the audience would like to make a comment on this proposal? If not, we'll go ahead and close the comment period time and open it. Oh, sorry.
I didn't have a comment card, but I do have a comment. I can just take a minute. My name is Dennis Winch. I'm a big game hunter. I've been my whole life, but I spent most of my time in southern Utah, and some of these good men have talked about our problem with the deer. We don't have a habitat problem at all. I agree with what's been said here tonight. In fact, I would be willing to take any of the biologists on habitat and take them in all of southern Utah. There's not a mountain down there I haven't been on for 50 years, from the Ponsiegont to the 50 Mile to clear back into Circle Cliffs, clear around, back over, clear on to Haystack Mountains out west, the Boulder Top, the Kaparowitz Plateau, you name them, Black Mountains. I've hunted on all of them, and you know, you take a horse on a lot of those right now, and they'd stumble in bitter brush. They can't even get through it. It's so good. I remember when I was a young boy, did a lot of mornings with my father, we'd see 30 to 40 big four-point bucks, you know, and go in those areas now, and there's nothing. And they don't even see a track. I can take you into 20, 30 areas that I used to hunt when I was a kid, and that the habitat, the bitter brush, the water's still there. There's not a Kmart or a subdivision for 100 miles, and the deer are gone. They're dead. They're in the spirit world. The problem is predators, and the biggest problem is, but yet the habitat is always where we seem to be. They beat it to death. You can plant a garden with the best seed, the best fertilizer, the best everything. You got
1,400 pheasants waiting for it to eat. As soon as you throw it out there when the fawns are dry or whatever, you're not going to have too much corn come up. Same analogy here. Anyway, I just wanted to put my two cents in that until we put predators, number one, take care of the predator problem. You can always control a certain amount of things in your farm. You can control how many hunters hunt, how many days they hunt, where they hunt. You can control predators, but you can't control how many fences they get caught in, how many cars run over them. There are certain things you can't control, so you need to deduct what you can control from what you can't control, and that's how you come up with the farming in a lot of these units. As far as the way I look at a lot of that, if you want to get the buck doe ratios up and the deer population, a lot of these areas I could take again, go in, they haven't even got 30 deer in the whole unit. I go out west here, they haven't even got 30 deer, let alone 25 bucks to 100 does. If you want to get the buck doe ratios up, you got to get the deer up, period. Each doe will have two fawns, and the odds are 50% of those will be bucks. That's not bad for a starter. So you get the deer population up, you're going to get the buck ratios up and get the ratios up, but you're not going to do that unless you address what's killing them. And I think until you find out that things with big teeth and claws and hunt them 24/7, so to say, they're a big problem. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Could I get you to fill out a comment card? Amanda, do you have any over there? Thank you. Okay, RAC members, we'll bring back to you. We have a proposal from the division. RAC members, what's your pleasure? Yep, we're gonna deal with the first agenda item before we move on to bucks and doe, or bucks and bulls. So what we're talking about is a motion to deal with the management plan amendment and the deer permit recommendations for 2012.
I make a motion we approve the recommendation of the division.
Okay, there's a motion on the floor by Jay that we approve the recommendation of the division. And is there a second?
Second.
Second from George. Additional comments on the motion? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and vote. All those in favor? Opposed? Okay, Amanda. Let's see the ayes first. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 ayes and opposed. Noes, got everybody? And the motion passes 7-3 in favor. I'd like to thank everybody who made a comment tonight. We appreciate it very much, and I would like to also thank the division for all of your hard work. I know hours and hours went into it, and we appreciate it very much, and we look forward to it. And hopefully everybody who puts in for a permit will get one. Okay, we'll go to the second action item, bucks, bulls, and Anise will make that presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, thank all the folks that commented. I think there's a lot of passion around mule deer hunting, and it shows here today. Okay. Now that general season's taken care of, we'll move to premium limited entry deer. As you know, we have two premium limited entry units in the state, the Henry Mountains and the Ponsagant. We manage buck hunting on those units in two different ways. We manage premium permits on the number of bucks harvested that are 5 years or older. So what we look for is a three-year average of 40 to 55% of the bucks harvested being 5 years or older. And if it goes above that 55%, we can recommend more permits. I've put up the what they are for the last 3 years and the three-year average, and as you can see on the Henry Mountains, it has gone above that 55, and is currently at 58. So we could recommend more permits for the premium tags on that unit. The Ponce Gant is still within the 40 to 55, so that one, no increase in permits is needed. We also manage on these units, we hunt what we call management bucks, and the reason we do that is to maintain a 5 year, a 40 to 55% of the harvest to be 5 years or older. You end up having a lot of excess bucks in the population. And to deal with that, we have to harvest those bucks, but we want to make sure we're not harvesting the big antlered animals that the limited premium limited entry hunters want to harvest. So what we've done to offer more opportunity and reduce buck doe ratios, we've put together what we call a management buck hunt. And I do want to clarify that this is not intended to change the genetics of the unit. It's just to offer more opportunity for those bucks that may never be a big 4-point on both sides. So for those, the way we manage them is we manage for 40 to 50 bucks per 100 does. And once we go above 50 bucks per 100 does, we would recommend increasing permits on those management buck permits strictly. And as you can see on the Henry Mountains, again, that's slightly above or quite a bit above that 50 bucks per 100 does. The Ponce Gant is good. It doesn't need to be changed. So given this information, our recommendation is to add 4 permits to the Henry Mountains and go from 44 permits to 48 permits. That is a 10% increase. In the statewide plan, it does state that we could never increase more than 10% in any given year. That kind of keeps us from for putting too many permits in any one year. The Ponce Gant, we are recommending no change in permits because that unit is within the objective. Now, as far as management permits, management buck permits on the unit, as I mentioned, once the unit gets above 50, we could issue more permits. And then we also have a baseline number of permits on that unit. On the Henry Mountains, it's 10 permits. On the Ponce Gant, it's 30. So even if it is within the range, we could still issue 10 and 30. So we're at 30 right now at the Henrys, and even though it is above, the region feels that if they put more permits out there, they would have some crowding issues on that mountain. So they decided not to increase permits and see one more year if that 30 permits that they have will bring the buck-to-doe ratio down. The Ponce Gant had 75 permits last year. They're starting to see a decline in the buck-to-doe ratio. They're currently at 48, so they want to lower the permits and see if that lower number of permits will actually level out the buck-to-doe ratio. So for management buck permits, we're recommending 30 on the Henry Mountains and 50 on the Ponce Gant. Okay, moving to to limited entry deer. Basically, the way we manage those units is we manage them for 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does postseason, and that's on a 3-year average. And as you can see from looking up there, I've color-coded. The ones that are in green, can be possibly increased. The ones that are not in green are ones that are meeting the objective and do not need to be increased. So as you can see on the Diamond Mountain, the Bookcliffs, and the San Juan Elk Ridge, we could recommend an increase in permits. We have not on the South Slope Diamond Mountain because a few years ago, they put a recommendation through to try to move towards premium limited entry on that unit. And so they don't want to increase permits till they get to a certain buck doe ratio. The Bookcliffs, even though we are slightly above, they have recommended not increasing permits, so it stays status quo. And the rationale for that, they've had fairly low fawn to doe ratios the last few years, and they expect that eventually will level out the buck to doe ratio and will start reducing it slightly in the next few years. The San Juan, they have increased slightly the number of permits. I think it's a token increase, but that unit is similar to the Bookcliffs. It's got very low fawn doe ratios. They're both mostly summer range limited units, so they don't have very high production. So given that, a minor reduction in permits, and the reason it's a reduction in permits, even though we stayed status quo, is the Thousand Lakes unit that used to be in the limited entry has now gone to general season, so those permits go along with it, and that's why you see a reduction in permits from last year. But for the most part, most of the permits are status quo. Okay, moving to general season and limited entry elk permit recommendations. In our statewide plan, it calls for spike permits to remain at 15,000 as long as hunt success rates are below 20%. And in 2011, the success rate was 13% statewide. So we're recommending maintaining that 15,000 spike permit statewide, basically no change from last year. We also recommend no change to the general any bull permit numbers with one exception. So basically, we still recommend 14,300 any bull permits statewide, 300 youth any bull permits statewide, and then the only change from last year is increase from 15 to 20, the late youth any bull permit. Those late youth any bull permits occur in the northeast region on the vernal subunit, and then they have actually expanded that boundary last, as you remember, in November, we came with a boundary change for that unit. And with that increased boundary, they feel they can offer a little bit more youth opportunity on some bulls that actually summer and early fall, they spend the time on private land and come on to public land later in the year, and that's why it's a late any bull unit. So the only change in recommendation there is adding five permits to that late youth hunt. Moving to limited entry elk permits, a minor decrease in permits there, but there's probably more to it than the total says. So we had a total of 2989 last year and a total of 2956 this year. But I'll go through the different units to kind of show you where those differences are. So as you know, we manage limited entry elk for an age of harvested bulls, a three-year average. And we have four tiers. So this is the top tier where we manage for an average of 7.5 to 8-year-old bull in the harvest. And that the three-year averages are there in that middle column. The yellow indicates that we should be either reducing permits or staying status quo. So either it's within the range or it's below the range. And then given that, we have chosen to reduce a total of 51 permits on those units to basically bring them up to objective. Now, those units, the reason they are below objective is the statewide plan actually raised the objective, so we were already behind, so we had to cut permits. Probably it's harder to catch up when you're raising objective than it is to issue enough permits to bring the ages down. So we do feel that the permits we've recommended will get us to those age objectives, and those are units that are well sought after, and a lot of hunters put in for a lot of years to draw these units. So the second tier is our 6.5 to 7-year-old class. So basically, we manage for a three-year average of 6.5 to 7-year-old bull in the harvest. Again, three of those four are below where we would like them, and so we have recommended a decrease in permits, total of 22 permits overall. Now, this is the third tier where we manage for a three-year average of 5.5 to 6-year-old bull in the harvest. And this is where probably the majority of the elk in the state reside in these are fairly large populations of elk, and we can offer a lot of opportunity on these units. As I mentioned, we manage for a 5.5 to 6-year-old bull in the harvest. So these are not managed for, you know, the highest of the high-quality antler size. But you can on occasion get a pretty good bull on these units. Again, the color coding shows where we could possibly increase and where we could possibly stay status quo or increase or decrease. And then when you add it all up, there's a 20 permit increase in there. Some units have increased quite a bit. Some have reduced a little bit because they're below objective. So overall, in the units where we have the majority of the elk in the state, we've added 20 permits. And this brings us to the lowest tier units that we manage for. These six units are managed for 4.5 to 5-year-old bull in the harvest. And as you can see, the majority of those are above objective, which necessitates a 35 permit increase when you do all the math. So given all that, you know, a slight decrease overall, but you can see how some units we've increased permits and some units we've reduced permits where we needed to. Okay. Moving to pronghorn permit recommendations. Again, that one, not a big change. We had 658 permits last year. We're recommending 665 permits this year. Majority of those permits are on the Cache North Ridge unit and the Plateau unit. The Plateau unit was just flown and has just reached objective again, so they were able to issue a few more permits. Once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. So we'll start with Moose. Last year we issued 93 permits. This year we're recommending 76 permits. Our moose populations in the state are fairly stagnant and maybe slightly declining in some parts of the state, probably with the exception of the Wasatch unit. So we want to take a look and see what's going on with moose. But given that some of our ages have come in, it'll be low objective, we're recommending a reduction in permits. Bison permits, 20 permits last year, 60 permits this year. I need to mention that this year, four of those permits are actually on the booklet, so now we have two units that we're hunting for bison. In the past, it was just a Henry Mountains unit. And the reason there's more permits is in the past, we were in growth mode, so we were trying to get to an objective of 325. We've gotten to that objective, plus our calf production is pretty high on the Henrys, so we're recommending increasing permits to maintain that population at the objective we've agreed to. And again, four permits of those is also on the book list. And that book list unit, just to be clear, is in that north western part of the book list that adjoins the Ute tribe. And most of the bison that will be harvested there will be bison that have actually come off the Ute tribe. The bison we transplanted there still don't have enough age class for us to be hunting them, so we won't be hunting the whole unit, just that small subunit, and we'll have four permits to try to take advantage of some of those bison that come off the tribe. Desert bighorn sheep, we're recommending a total of three permit decrease. Actually, there's one unit that we've actually increased permits on, but a few units where we've reduced permits. The San Rafael, both units, we're recommending a decrease in permits because populations there are not doing that great. And we do have a research project going on in the north San Rafael looking at to see what the reason is. The Rocky Mountain Bighorn, we're adding four permits. So we had 30 last year, 34 this year. Most of those are coming off of the rattlesnake and the Booklifts unit where we have a pretty healthy sheep population. Rocky Mountain Goat, also an increase in permits from 133 last year to 165 this year. Those permits are mostly on the Beaver unit, on the Tushers, and on the Ogden-Willard Peak unit. Both of those have populations that are above where the Forest Service would like to see them, and we've made a commitment to them that we would issue more permits to try to bring those populations down. We will likely be doing some transplants off of those areas as well in conjunction with these number of permits. Okay, so those were the recommended permit numbers. There's a couple, or actually three, recommended rule changes. One has to deal with muzzleloader hunting. So basically in the past, the black powder that hunters could use could not contain nitrocellulose or be smokeless powder. There is a new product out on the market called Blackhorn 209 that actually contains nitrocellulose. And we've had some people ask us if this could become legal to use. So our law enforcement folks looked at some of the research that had been done and saw that on average studies show that it increases velocity of a projectile of about 5%. And they didn't feel that made it that much more effective than a rifle. So they decided to go ahead and strike nitrocellulose based out of the rule and allow the use of Blackhorn 209. It's also a cleaner burning powder, which is keeps it easier to clean muzzle loaders between shots. So they didn't see a downside to it where it only increased velocity by 5%. So it's a recommendation we're making to strike nitrocellulose out of the rule and just let them use black powder and that does not contain smokeless powder. The second rule change is basically to allow for the use of one blood-trailing dog controlled by a leash during lawful hunting hours. And within 72 hours of shooting a big game animal, they should be allowed to track a wounded animal and aid in recovery. This provides a means for hunters to increase their chances of locating and harvesting wounded games, big game, and will lead to decreased wounding loss. This is the same law as allowed in Idaho, and basically our law enforcement folks use the same language that Idaho has to change that rule. I think it would be, we've had a lot of people ask us about this, and I think our law enforcement folks researched it and felt that it would be one that they could get behind. Okay, the third amendment to the rule basically allows hunters that have two antlerless elk permits for the same area but at different seasons to harvest those antlerless elk in any of the two seasons. This was a unique situation that happened last year where we had a hunter ask us about that. And, right off the bat, I said, yeah, they should be able to do that. But when I talked to our law enforcement folks, they said, no, the rule actually does not allow for that. And it really didn't make sense. So we asked them if it would be okay to change that rule, and they agreed to do that because it really, if someone has two antlerless elk permits, it's a rare thing, but if someone does have those on the same unit but for different seasons and they happen to have an opportunity to harvest two at the same time, it really doesn't make sense not to let them. So that's what this rule does. That's all I have. I thank you, and be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you again, Anise. Questions from the RAC members?
I have one question.
Jay?
On the once-in-a-lifetime, on the moose and the goat, both numbers went down, yet the non-reds went up.
Actually, the goats went up. But, and there's a good reason for that. The way we do our rounding on limited entry is 10%. So when they reach 5, they could have one non-resident. And they could go all the way up to 9 and still have one non-resident. So even though we cut the permits, you could still have more non-resident permits per capita. I don't know if that makes sense. So you can have five permits and it would be 4 resident, 1 non-resident. You could have 9 permits and it would be 8 resident and 1 non-resident. So even though the numbers declined, the rounding still allowed for 8 non-residents.
That don't make sense.
Okay. I'll try to explain it a little better. So say you had 5 permits.
Let's just look at the moose.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So because they're different units and each have different permit numbers.
Oh, okay.
So say a one unit had 10 permits last year, it would have been one non-resident. Now it has 5 permits, it would still be one non-resident. And then so that's kind of how it's rounding stuff. It's I know it's confusing. That's a question that's come up in a couple of racks. We always round up to the benefit of the non-residents just because they don't get very many permits and it's 10% of the total.
Other questions for Anise? Dwayne?
I have a couple, and it's probably because I'm not paying enough attention. On your elk permits on the Deep Creeks, mm-hmm. You're looking at your age classification. It looked to me like you were well above objective. You were at a 7.2, and yet you reduced the number of permits.
Yeah, that one's a little bit unique. The majority of the elk on that unit reside on the tribe, and we kind of get their slop over. So what's happened is we tried to increase permits incrementally to get that age down, but it just hasn't happened. But what has happened is our satisfaction rate is starting to go down, so we're seeing hunter crowding issues. So the biologist there felt like, it doesn't matter how many permits we throw out there, we're not going to get that age down. So we're going to try to make sure our satisfaction doesn't, decline below.
So that's why you cut them, even though it's 7.2.
Yeah, exactly. This year we had a lot of complaints, and it showed in our surveys as well. The satisfaction index really went down.
Okay. I have a question on the bison. You talked about the fact that there was a big increase because of what was happening on the tribe.
No, the big increase is on the Henrys mostly.
Yeah, that's
where we've reached. We were in growth mode, and now we've reached where we need to be. So now we need to issue more permits to hold them there.
Okay, I have a question about that. It seems to me that a couple of years ago that we had a really big debate in regards to bison numbers, and Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife weighed in about all the habitat increase that they had done,
right,
and that you guys were still bound by the number that you had agreed to with BLM and whoever was there.
So
what's the situation there, that all that habitat improvement was to increase the number of bison? Was there above that magic number of Bureau of Reclamation? Are you going back to try and manage to that number?
No. So I'll explain a little bit. So the old objective was 275. The new objective is 325. So what happened is before we could start going towards 325, we actually needed to get to the original objective of 275. That was the agreement we made with them. So we got to 275, and then over the last few years have been increasing the number of bison, so reducing permits, to get to 325. Now we've reached where we needed to be, where we need to be. And then to maintain that, you need to issue more permits to basically take into consideration the production that's happening. So no, we're not managing for the old 275, we're managing for the new 325. And that's the one, that's a number that was agreed upon from the whole committee that was formed, including SFW
with,
and all
with
of those.
The habitat improvement that was there.
I mean, obviously, I'll be honest, we could carry more, but we had, there was concessions made on all sides to
be. I know that.
Yeah.
20 to 60 is a big jump.
Yeah, it was a phenomenal calf production year last year. So we take all that into consideration, and then survival rates on bison is virtually nil. I mean, mortality is virtually nil. I mean, the ones we collared and put on the book list, we have yet to have one die. So once they get to a year old, they're basically indestructible, unless a bullet hits them.
But a drought year will impact productivity.
Yeah, but last year, so we're working on last year's production.
Yeah, versus what might happen. All right.
Richard.
Since we went to the statewide spike elk hunting, has that affected the average or of the age classification of the animals that are been harvested in the unit?
Yeah, I guess the short answer is no, because obviously, at least the lowest unit we manage for is for 4.5 to 5 year old. So we haven't had the program in place 4 years yet to see those spikes become 4 year old. I don't expect we'll see it on the units we manage for the lowest until we're 4 years into the program, and on the units we manage for the highest until we're 7 years into the program.
So like on the Monroe. I hear a lot of complaints.
Yeah.
You know, down there. And quite frankly, there's a lot fewer elk down there. I mean, we have a cabin down there. We first went down there 8 years ago. I mean, it's just incredible. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's sometimes you're lucky to see three or four.
Sure. Yeah, so, that unit is kind of unique, I guess, because it's well-roaded and there's a lot of access. And elk are very sensitive to that. So when you're not harvesting spikes, they're going to be more visible. But when you are harvesting spikes, they're going to be less visible. Not only that, we do harvest quite a few spikes on that unit, but that should not yet be affecting the age classes that we're talking about on here, because, you know, there's very few spikes in the harvest, obviously, the limited entry harvest. And then until they reach that age class, it shouldn't affect the ages. So we may see it, you know, a few years down the road, but yet we haven't. So we'll keep watching that. That's one unit where we're probably getting more spike harvest than we think than we probably counted on. But still, it's not above what can be sustained.
Okay. Yes, Carl.
Recently, we issued some tags and then pulled back some tags on the plateau antelope.
Yeah.
On that, can you comment a little bit more about that herd? We're recommending an increase here, and
sure.
If I remember right, it's only been a year or so since we pulled those tags back.
So that herd is a very productive herd, and we did see a blip on the screen a couple years ago where we actually had winter mortality, and we see that rarely out there, but it was a more severe winter than we've ever seen in that country. So we did see the majority of the fawns die and a few adults, and then the following year was very low production because pronghorn tend to reabsorb their fetuses when they're stressed. So, but But they also, when they get down to those low numbers, are quick to rebound as well. They can have triplets and really go gangbusters. And the habitat there is such that it can increase. So when they flew it this past, I guess, a few weeks ago, they actually were at objective, which is 1,500 animals. And if we don't put permits on it, it could get away from us pretty quick. There is talk to try to get a committee down there and increase that objective, because I think we can carry more pronghorn on that unit. It's just one of those things where you have to work it out with all of the parties.
Thanks. Other questions? If not, we'll turn it over to the audience. Audience members, any questions for Anis on his presentation? Come on up and introduce yourself again.
Ty Bolter. Seem to always have questions. on our limited entry elk, if I remember correctly, we raised objective or age objectives a couple years ago. Is that right?
Yeah.
What can we anticipate in the next couple years when we start to get closer to those objectives and kind of get into maintenance mode? Do we end up losing tags? What does that look like?
Yeah, so all the calculations we've done is, it will probably, a leveling off point is around 2,500 tags statewide.
And we have, 2,900-ish?
3,000, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we'll lose about 500 once we level off. Right now, in a lot of the units, and especially the biggest units in the state, we're still trying to kill more elk to get get them to objective. On some of the higher objective units, we're cutting tags, but those units tend to have fewer elk, so it doesn't play into the tag reduction as much.
Gotcha. And then this question, actually, I was going to ask Greg, but he's not here. Is this Alan? Are you taking his spot? I was browsing through tag allocations and things like that a few months back, and I noticed that for this year, this year's tag recommendations for all the different species for conservation tags, we are grossly over the 5% rule that's in place for several species. Moose, I think, was 30%. We gave out 30% of moose tags to conservation and convention tags last year. Are you guys looking at that and looking to rectify that? And if so, are you going to change the rule, or are you going to actually rectify that with the conservation tag allocation number?
Yeah, so we are going to change the rule to deal with that. And the reason for that is we had a lot more moose permits when the three-year permits were set, and they are set for 3 years. So when we reduce permits, it ends up being a higher percentage. So we have put a provision in the rule that will be going out. It's not finalized yet, that we'll try to deal with that. So basically, if we see something out of the ordinary, we can adjust.
So you're going to make it so you can make adjustments that year to scale it back to be in proportion?
Again, the rule's not finalized yet, but that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Okay, I'd love to be kept in the loop on it. Appreciate it.
And I think the rule's coming out this next rec.
Other questions?
My name's Phil Dunn. I just noticed that there's a lot of hunting going on in November and December. It seemed like when things were a little better, the late hunt seasons weren't going on, and I wonder if that affects we hunt our animals from the middle of August till about the end of December. There's no rest for the animals to recoup during that time, even if there's just one season going on. I wonder if that has a little bit of effect on the deer and when they're mating.
Sure. So we try to minimize any deer hunting, so most of our buck deer hunting ends by the end of October. We don't hunt any buck deer after that. We do hunt some elk after that on limited entry units, and we do hunt quite a few antlerless that go into December, but they're not on a statewide basis. So we have a hunt going at any given time, but there's not complete pressure on any unit from from September 1st to the end of November, and the reason for that is antlerless animals especially elk, are hard to kill in any other season but the late season. And that's where we find our highest success rates. And on units where we're over-objective on elk and we need to harvest these animals, you know, it makes sense to put those permits where we can get the harvest. We are moving more and more permits into the general season, but we see a much lower success rate there. So it's kind of a trade-off that we do. But so, yeah, we try to minimize that, but sometimes it's not something we can get around if we need to get the harvest.
Other questions?
My name's Brad Baxter, and I've heard you say that the San Juan Elk Ridge has poor fawn production. Is that what I heard?
That's
and
correct.
Did you say it was because of habitat in the summer?
The Elk Ridge portion is summer range limited, yes.
Yeah, well, you know, 5 out of the last 10 years I've been hunting down there during the archery hunt with family. Sometimes you can hear coyotes in 4 different directions at night. Now, that's where your fawns are going. Your fawns are not going to habitat. There's plenty of habitat there. There's hardly any deer scattered anywhere. But yet, at night, you hear in 4 different directions packs of coyotes. So that unit's dear to me. You know, I grew up hunting it a lot, and it's not the summer range. It's coyotes. So just thought I'd bring that up.
Thank you. Other questions?
Dave Woodhouse. I was just curious. I'm looking at this, and why is there about 170 more limited entry elk tags on the Wasatch than the Manti when you're talking you've got twice the elk herd on the Manti? Is there...
Sure. Yeah, I can explain.
Where's that number?
So basically, as you know, we manage for ages in the harvest, and the ages in the harvest continue to go up on both units. And our population estimates are winter estimates, so there actually could be more elk summering on the Wasatch than on the Manti, but where they winter is different. So hard to say why, but as long as ages continue to go up, we can add more permits.
Yeah, because I'm looking at the age class, and they're actually going down, but...
Well, they're both still above it.
Yeah, they're above, but they're going down, which...
Which you would expect, because we've been putting a lot of permits on these units.
Yeah, and so I was just curious why there would be...
Yeah, that's the rationale.
Other questions? We'll go ahead and close the question period then and open it up for comments. I think I only have 3 comment cards. If you do want to make a comment, please fill one out. Ben Louder, you want to make a comment on this presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ben Louder, representing Utah Bowman's Association. Pretty simple. Utah Bowman's Association supports the division's recommendations as presented tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Ben. That's what we'd like to hear. Michael Anderson. Great, thank you. And Ty, do you have a comment?
Sure. I'll never turn down an opportunity.
Come on up. I mean, come on down.
As the president of the United Wildlife Cooperative, I'd like to support the division's recommendations.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Dave Woodhouse, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. On the Wasatch Mountains unit, we would ask that the RAC address the elk tag numbers on the limited entry elk tag numbers, and instead of the increase, to roll it back to 2009 levels, because we're seeing a decline in the age class, and we're just, you know, 4 tenths above the objective, and there was more of a decline than that from last year to now. And with another increase, we expect that will go down, and then we will be in a cut mode again. And if you do a parallel with the Beaver or the Pavant units and where they went to, and then the cuts that had to go into them to bring them back in line at this time, you see significant cuts, and it takes a longer time. We're getting close to the level where we want. And so we would like to ask the RAC to address that at this time. And, you know, rather than the increase in the tag numbers on the Wasatch and the Manti, to look at a holding pattern of where we were last year in tag numbers, or even back to the 2009 levels, in order to, you know, avoid a steep decline in the age class objective where we have to have a significant cut and take years to come back. It'd be nice to get one to the level and hold it there, and we could know what we have and what we're going to have from year to year instead of, you know, adjusting every year. And, you know, if you look at the data of what they have in the decline, there's no reason to suggest that if we even went to last year's tag numbers that we wouldn't hit that number this year and put it right at the medium of the age class objective. Other than that, you know, we support the recommendations of the DWR on this. And, you know, I'd like to, it'd be kind of nice to see a little debate and not cut you guys. It was surprising to see you last cut that other one so short, no debate. But anyways, that's just my personal thing there. Thanks.
Thanks, Dave. Other comments? Yes. Thank you.
Kim Hansen. I just had to hurry and fill out a card because I really agree with Dave's comments on that, on the elk numbers in the Wasatch and the Manti. And I'd like to see those numbers rolled back as well. So that's my only comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Kim. Seeing no other comments, I'm going to close the comment period down. But Anise, would you like to comment on the on those last two recommendations?
Sure. Yeah, so basically the concern they have is we have seen a reduction from 1 year to the next in ages, but the 3 year age objective is still above objective. So we're recommending an 8% increase on the Wasatch, which is not, you know, a huge increase, but it does, because they have so many permits, it ends up in a lot of permits. So, again, we're still above objectives on both of those units. We wouldn't recommend decreasing at all, let alone 250 permit decrease on the Wasatch. If we go back to 220 permit decrease. Is a pretty big decrease. And what we've seen in the past on these units is even when we held status quo, we saw the age jump back up. But we've done the same thing on the Manti, where 1 year they saw a big dip. They held permits the same as last year, and they saw an increase. And, I can't say where the level is, where we will level off. There will become a point where we'll have to cut permits. I do agree that we can't sustain this kind of harvest forever. We don't have that many, we shouldn't have that many bulls on the unit, but right now we do. So if we want to get to objective, we need to issue more permits.
Thank you.
I had a guy call me on the phone, and he's concerned about the number of antlerless permits for elk on a portion of the Wasatch. I think it's the Wasatch.
Yeah. Aren't you going to address that in the next?
Yeah, and this is the next presentation.
Okay, I'll wait.
Thanks.
Anise, just looking at the Manti numbers in particular, you know, from 2010 to 2011, we went down, you know, 0.3 inches. We're 6.1 in 2011. I understand that you're looking at the 3 year average, but it would seem like a little safer number maybe to go with 2011 permit numbers.
Yeah, you know, certainly that would be the safer number, but it may not get you to objective because, as I mentioned on the Manti specifically, we saw the same trend 3 or 4 years ago, and they did do status quo, and we saw a bump in age. You know, again, we're dealing with biological systems. They could surprise you. You know, we're not saying we know all there is to know, but based on the trends, the information we have, we would recommend a slight increase in permits on that unit. Again, if you go status quo, we can kind of see what happens. What I would hope is if we do go status quo and we see a bump next year, that we don't go status quo again, I guess.
Right. Well, just, and I know, again, I understand we use the three-year average, right. But looking at the trend, it seems like it's trending down quite sharply on the mantine.
Yes.
And so it would seem we may not want to raise permits this year.
Agreed, it's trending down, and I agree with you. We look at trends as well, but even the trend trending down, the last number is still above objective.
Sure.
So the 6.1 is still above. So, again,
let me ask you this: if you did the 2011 permits, what number would you expect to see next year as far as the average age of harvest?
It would be probably the same as it is this year, and maybe
6.1.
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, it'd be hard.
I know it's a guess.
Yeah,
but
it's a guess. I mean, it would either be the same or it may bump up. You never know. There's so many bulls on the mountain, so.
Well, let me tell you.
We're getting a good sample size because we're harvesting a lot of animals, so you're getting a representative sample of what's out there.
The reason why I asked that, because I'm looking at this, in 2011 we issued 452 permits.
Mm-hmm.
And from after that harvest, it looked like we went down 3 points in the average
right.
harvest.
Mm-hmm.
Would you, from a layman's perspective, you would expect if you issue the same amount of permits that after 2012 you'd see a similar reduction.
And you may. And, you know, I'm not going to say you won't because, you know, again, we're working – you know, in an ever-changing system, and that's why we do it 1 year
at
a time.
Sure. All right. Thanks.
You bet.
Okay, RAC members, we're bringing the presentation back to you, Larry. And what we're going to do, you have a question for Anise? Okay.
I don't know if I have do you know that information? Success rate? The overall weapon types, 80% success overall weapon types. So that includes muzzleloader and archery.
Is that an average success rate, or is it higher or lower?
Yeah, I'm sure the rifle was higher. I assume, yeah. Rifle is usually higher, but archery is usually lower.
Compared to years in the past.
This one? Compared to past years? He's asking if success was similar to past years.
Because it was just an odd year last year.
Yeah, it was an odd year, but it has dropped down over the last couple of years. But normally we manage that thinking it's going to be close to 100%.
Yeah, that they're talking about the age classification in that particular unit. People that I've talked to personally, the ages that they've got in. I know maybe they just look for a better bull, but they've been quite higher.
And that happens a lot. People end up not getting a bull because they're looking for the biggest one that they can find, and that, I think, has some effect on those success rates. Hunter satisfaction index is up to 71% are satisfied or neutral.
You know, and we're going to get into the numbers also, but we're still way above our elk number limit.
You mean our objective?
Our objective.
Yes, we're still way over it. And in fact, that and the manti, in the 20 years that we've been hunting as a limited entry unit, we have never been at objective. It's always been over.
Yes.
We're still trying to get it down within objective.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, RAC members, it's time to deliberate, offer motions, and make recommendations to the Wildlife Board.
I'm going to go ahead and make a motion that we cut back to 30 tags on the Manti limited entry elk, go back to 2011.
Okay, is it?
On the Central Mountains, too. I mean, on the Wasatch.
I was just looking at the Central Mountains Manti.
Well, do the Wasatch, then I'll say.
I'm just doing the Central Mountains.
Oh, you're going to do it.
We can do it two motions if you'd like. I'm just going to be central.
Okay, there is a motion to take the tags on the Manti, to keep them as they were this past year. And there's a second by Richard. Discussion on that motion? All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 in favor. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4. It passes 6-4. Wait a minute. Amanda needs to see your hands. Those who are opposed? Got it. Okay. Now, motion by Jay.
Yes, to leave the number, that the 2011 number on the Wasatch.
On the Wasatch. Is there a second to that? Second by Richard.
That's 603. The number 603 instead of the 652 recommendation.
So we're reducing the number of tags. How much? Over recommendation? 49 fewer tags. Mm-hmm. And how many fewer tags was it in the...
30 on the Manti.
30 on the Manti. Okay, a second... Richard seconded Jay's. Further discussion?
Yeah, I've got a comment. I just want to clarify why I didn't include that in my motion. When I look at the Wasatch Mountains, I mean, it looks like we're well above the objective. And we are trending down... But it looks like we've got some work to do before we get down to objective. So from my perspective, that's why I didn't include the Wasatch Mountains in my motion, because I felt like it seems like the extra tags are justified looking at the numbers.
Okay, further discussion?
Problem is they kill the bigger bulls, and so that's bringing the age objective up. If you kill the bigger bulls, when you make that drastic of an increase, then your reduction is going to go, or your objective, your age is going to go way down.
Right.
We can take care of the numbers in the antlers.
Right.
Get down to objective.
That's why. I mean, it's trending down, but it's still well above.
Okay, further discussion on the motion? Everybody understand it? All those in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4 in favor. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 opposed. Amanda, did you get those? That motion is defeated. Four in favor, six opposed. Now I'm ready for a motion to approve the rest of the recommendation as presented by Tim.
Move that we accept the recommendations for all of the units as proposed.
For the rest of the recommendation for limited entry. Second? Second by Tim. All in favor? Opposed? Passes unanimously. And we will move on to antlerless permit recommendations. Anise?
Thank you again. So next we'll be presenting the 2012 antlerless recommendations.
That was part of this presentation.
And our antlerless recommendations are meant to basically harvest antlerless animals that will get us to objective or deal with a specific issue that where we need population reduction. This is that same graph I showed in the last presentation of fawn-doe ratio. So basically, it kind of shows you what deer numbers are doing. It's kind of a surrogate for populations. When you get an increase in fawn-doe ratios, you get an increase in population. Obviously, we're probably at about a stagnant... So populations are slightly declining... when you look at mule deer populations.
At this time,
thank you. This graph shows the population estimates that we have for mule deer in our 2013 target population. We're obviously below objective, and populations are declining. Given that, we are recommending 290 antlerless permits. All but 150 of those permits are to deal with either town deer or depredation issues. There are 150 permits on the Penguich Lake unit along the Parowan front where we are seeing habitat damage occurring on that winter range, and we would like to reduce the number of mouths on that mainly mule deer that winter there. So we're recommending two hunts with a total of 150 permits on that unit. So with the exception of that, all the others are the other 140 permits are to deal with depredation and nuisance issues. Moving to elk is a little bit different story. Our elk population objective statewide is around 69,000. We're currently at about 75 or just above 75,000 elk in the state. So we obviously are above objective. Given that, we're recommending increasing permits statewide from 12,174 last year to 13,108 this year, close to 1,000 permit increase. Those are meant to go on units where we're either at or above objective to either reduce populations or maintain populations. Even units where we are at objective require a lot of permits to maintain at objective because elk actually have, you know, our survival rates on their calves are a lot different than they are on our mule deer. So they have a tendency to grow very rapidly. Elk control permits, these are permits that are offered to hunters that purchase an antlered or once-in-a-lifetime permits on these units. They're basically on units where either we want zero elk or because of private land or tribal issues, we're not able to harvest enough antlerless elk. So this provides hunters that already have a tag, they're out there hunting, if they see a cow, they can harvest it, and it's a reduced cost as well. So the three units where we want zero elk, where we offer these permits, are the Henry Mountains, the San Rafael, and the San Juan Any Bull unit. And then the five units where, because of private land or tribal land issues, we're unable to harvest enough elk, antlerless elk, to control the population. Those include the 9 Mile Range Creek, East Canyon, and Chalk Creek. The two that are in yellow are new, the Morgan South Ridge and the South Slope Yellowstone. The others that are in white were in place the last couple of years. So we are adding two new units to try to control populations on those two units. Okay, moving to pronghorn, we're recommending a slight increase in doe pronghorn permits. We had 467 total permits last year. We're recommending 527 permits this year. Some of that increases on the plateau units. They're offering 100 doe permits on the plateau this year to deal with some potential population growth there. We are recommending no moose permits. As I mentioned earlier, we're seeing some issues with moose that we want to investigate before we harvest antlerless moose. Populations are fairly stable to slightly declining, and we want to see what's going on there before we can issue any permits. That's the antlerless presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Anise. Questions from the rack? Richard?
Yeah, Anise, up on the Wasatch, and these couple guys here will know that a lot better than I will, but I received a personal phone call from a particular person up there. He said there's a part of that unit that the elk really, there's not very many elk on there. And yet, you look on the population numbers for that, and it's huge. But I guess the problem is that most of those elk are on non-huntable lands, on private lands. And so the guys that buy a tag for that or, you know, dry out for a tag are not hunting 100% of those elk, you know, 100% of bulls, or however you want to look at it. They're hunting maybe 40% of them, 30% of them. Is there anything we can do about it?
I guess I'll have to defer that to the region. I'm not as familiar with the boundaries they put, but usually we try to put boundaries to target where we think we have overpopulations. But again, I'll let the region.
Craig?
Yeah, thank you, Richard.
I know a lot about that unit. I've managed it myself for years and have been in this region my entire career. So I know it really well. It does have property issues, but they're very small compared to the unit as a whole. And the elk are there. We had a different year this year. The spring produced phenomenal vegetation. Elk were summering in areas where they don't normally summer, and therefore moving out of areas to where people would be scouting or hunting and not being able to find the elk. And then when we turned around and had an open winter, and the elk wintered higher, and once the gates were closed, shut down, so they didn't have as good as access to it. They couldn't get to the elk, and so hunter success was down. Hunters were complaining about not finding elk, but you know, our flight did show that they were there. Did you have a specific area?
I don't really remember. I know that this particular person is an outfitter out of Heber, and they just says they know it well, but they're seeing a decline over several years now, they said, not just last year. And they're really concerned with the number of permits, antlers permits, that was being proposed. Because they feel like the herd is actually going down.
I've heard the same concerns over some of the antlerless permit numbers that we're letting out there. However, when we did flight, we flew that, not this past winter, but the winter before, and when we flew that, we were 900 head over objective just on our portion of the Wasatch West, and that would be this portion that he'd be talking about. So we, based on the year before success rate, which was 6.1 or 61%, we based our recommendation on that to give enough permits to bring that 900 down, as well as the production that would be produced that year. And then when we had this open winter, we never received the harvest that we were planning on. The harvest was only a success rate of 32.3, I think it was. And so therefore, the only thing we really did is we took care of that production, but we did not reduce the number by the 900 number down to where it would be within objective. So basically what we needed to do is turn around and have the same number of tags, the 1450, in order to bring that number back down, and hopefully this next season our success rates will be back up to where they normally are, between 50 and 60% overall.
Is there an inordinate amount of elk on those private lands compared to the rest of the unit?
The only there's two CWMUs up there, and for the most part, those elk don't come on until later in the season. So there's a possibility there around Heber. There's also Wolf Creek Ranches, which is a large parcel of about 15,000 acres that the elk move into. And we have been working with those guys to try to turn that into a CWMU. A lot of those people are out-of-state homeowners and don't want hunting there. We were able to get them to have...
May I have your attention, please? The library will be closing in 10. We ask that you bring items for checkout to the run at the time. We will be happy to assist you there. Thank you, and have a good night.
We were able to get them to take a few permits this year, and we will continue to work with them as much as we can and try to get more hunters into that area. The rest of it should be open to hunting.
Thanks. CWMU also increased the ramblers' tags, one of the operators, to help out.
Yes, we've worked with the CWMU operators. They work with us really well, and just about anything that we ask, they'll bend over backwards.
That was going to be my question was, is there more opportunity to get, you know, some of those tags moved over to CWMUs and see if we can't take some more of those elk off CWMUs rather than so much pressure on the public portion?
Yeah, we have looked at that, and we have done exactly that. But the problem with the CWMU is that the minimum is 10,000 acres that they can have to create the CWMU, and then once... which we'll get into CWMUs next, but most of them will be between 10,000 and 15,000 acres, and that seems like a lot, until you start putting quite a few hunters on there, and you can push elk off of it really easily. And so whenever we try to increase permits on a CWMU to handle that population, which we need to, we also at the same time have to try to increase permits around the CWMU so if they go off, they're still hunted and we still can control the population.
On the antlerless portion of that, well, from an antlerless perspective, do you see a situation on the Wasatch where maybe we ought to look at that 10,000 acre requirement and perhaps reduce that a little bit? Do you see that as a possible?
Well, if we reduce it, it makes it easier to run elk off of it. So if we want to have the landowner be more involved in creating habitat for wildlife, protecting wildlife, growing a herd that will spill off to, for the general public, and we want big enough units that will contain a population more year-round than just seasonal. And so a bigger unit actually helps out.
I was just wondering if some of these elk are seeking refuge on and then parcels of land that are smaller than 10,000, so unless the landowner draws a tag, right, or gets a mitigation tag.
Yeah, most of those lands are usually open to the public, even if they're private. Okay.
So you don't see much opportunity there to get more people on private property hunting if we looked at some of those.
Yeah, and one of the things we have done on that, we've eliminated one, at least one of the hunts, and then we've taken some of the numbers and tried to move them during the general hunt, which is actually a lower success hunt, so we've had to increase numbers a little bit to compensate for that. But, control the numbers is a big thing, and try to get the elk harvested to bring within the population objective. We're always dealing with that. And trying different creative ways to try to not have them on the lake hunt so much that we're disturbing deer, as has been mentioned, but at the same time to have a success rate high enough that we can control the population and address depredation problems, especially around the Heber Valley at the same time.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Other questions?
Yeah, I had a question for Anise on the doe tags, 290 doe tags. Are they just token nuisance? I mean, are they municipalities that are...
All but 150 of those are. So 140 of them are, to deal with either deer that are in crops during the summer, so they're like late August, early September hunts. The only exception, as I mentioned, is the 150 permits that are on the Parowan front to deal directly with habitat damage that we're seeing on the habitat there. So there are actually too many deer wintering for whatever habitat. It's about a mile wide and about, I don't know, maybe 20 miles long, but they have a very restricted range there. So we need to remove some animals there to actually not have the sagebrush and the littlebrush die.
The cars aren't doing it for you then, huh?
No,
in that area,
it's all fence, so they can't They used to migrate across and winter on the other side, and we're working with UDOT to try to get some structures put into that stretch of highway. It's just really hard after the highway's been built to do that.
Okay, thanks.
Other questions, George?
Yes. What criteria is necessary to be listed as an area where, due to private land, the hunting pressure is not allowed to... I just noticed, yeah.
So usually what fits under that is this primarily private land. So if almost the entire unit is private land and there's only a few parcels of public land, that would be the kind of situation where we would not increase permits, knowing that even if we had increased permits, hunters wouldn't find a place to go. So an example of that is in the northern region where we've combined all those to be those. I'm assuming you're talking about.
I'm talking about my field.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's not. I guess that's not what we consider. If the unit's primarily public land, that's not a one field is not
a
consideration.
East Heber is not considered.
No.
Other questions? We'll close the question period then for the RAC members. Open it up to audience. Do you have any questions for Anise on this presentation? Dave?
Thanks. Actually, it's for Craig. What was the success rate on the limited entry on the Wasatch, the bull?
Close to 80%.
80%. Do we know what, like, the spike? What was it? You said... Around 12 statewide.
Yeah, ran around 13 statewide.
And that's average year after year on the spike?
Pretty much. It can get into the 16, 17 sometimes percent success.
Okay. And then what was your... the cow success rate this year on the Wasatch?
Like you said, it was 32%.
32, which is low.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, we're saying... could it be because the cows just aren't there? I mean, not necessarily that they've moved to different pastures, because we still got to the bulls. They were there.
Yeah, no, the elk were there. The elk were there. When we fly that, we fly a grid pattern up and down every ridge on the winter range, count every animal that we see. We don't go back over it so that we're never doing a double count. So if anything, we're going to be low on our count.
Yeah, and now, if I remember last year when you your counts in the Spanish Fork River drainage was lower than the other end of the, you were saying about Provo, and to the north end of the unit was higher as far as your herd counts, and they were lower.
I'd have to look at the data on that again. I don't remember whether they were lower or higher.
All right, I was just wondering if we could lower those cow tags on the, because I know the success rate was low on the Dyna Fork and that, because the guys weren't finding them. And,
yeah,
well, we're
and
not
I,
seeing
I don't
them.
Think we're, I don't think we're having as many tags on the Diamond Fork area in that part of the unit.
I think it's higher than it was last year.
What we really want to do is try to reduce the elk around the Heber Valley, because we receive a lot of depredation. But we still have the objective of the herd, so if we reduce in one area, we'd have to increase in another.
Okay.
And some of those permits on the Diamond Fork area, Springville, we move some of those permits during the general season, which covers the whole unit and not just one specific area.
All right. Thanks.
Other questions?
Mike Christensen. Try to make this quick. Have we given private land only doe tags? The division issued those in the past for certain units. I mean, I remember something where it was dealing with depredating deer that was private land only.
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly what you're talking. There are some areas that we outlined that are where we have problems where it's primarily private land. Yeah, so hunters, in order to hunt, have to access private lands. But those aren't. The landowners don't have the tags. The public does.
Exactly. So those tags are issued through the draw.
Correct.
So, do you think it would behoove us to make some private land only elk permits in these areas on the Wasatch that the public perception is the public lands elk are getting hammered and the private lands elk are not?
But yeah, I guess it's a little bit different situation because the private lands deer tags we tend to issue are usually associated with agriculture.
Uh-huh.
The elk issues are usually rangeland issues, and it's harder to have a private land hunt. What you can do is, and I think they've done that, is shape the hunt such that it encompasses mostly the private land, and I think the regions try to do that already. When they have a problem in an area, they draw a boundary that encompasses that area.
Thanks.
Other questions? We'll go ahead and close the question period then and open it up for your comments on the presentation. I don't have any comment cards on the antler list, but I'm happy to accept some. Thank you. And thank you. Is John Dunn still here? No. Okay. Ty. Gotcha.
I was trying to get after Mike. Ty Bolter, United Wildlife Cooperative. I received phone calls probably from some of the same guys Richard did, some outfitters in Heber, and a lot of other people who consider the Wasatch their home. myself included. So I've got some opinions. I think a lot of them initially when we started handing out higher allocations for cow tags last year were really shocked and went, their counts are off, we're killing too many elk. Well, I know you guys flew the unit last year and your sightability was great. And so I spent a lot of time talking with them and saying, hey, here's the data and here's what's happened. This year, with the increase that's coming, obviously it's a shock to someone who they look at the population estimate. It's roughly 7,100 elk, I think. And we're handing out 4,000 cow tags. They're, you know, to the layperson, that may translate to we're killing 4,000 elk, which is half of our herd or better. My question, actually my comment, is I'm wondering, well, I guess it's a question and a comment. I think it would be good, if possible, not to figure out ways to pinpoint them a little better. You know, these guys, what the conclusion they've come to is, we have all of these elk, same thing, on private property. Strawberry Valley is, you know, struggling, more or less. You know, we've got a ton of elk on the Aviniquin side up higher. We've got a ton of elk, you know, on these private lands and CWMUs, and they're not getting killed. So we have population objectives that need to come down. And, you know, similar to what Richard said. My question is, can maybe we look at flying this unit again just as a matter of due diligence to make sure, you know, we got done what we needed to get done and weren't really detrimental, you know, in it to the elk population. Is there a possibility, John, of flying that again next year? I know it's not scheduled, I don't think. Are you allowed to answer?
We're backed up. We didn't fly some units this winter because we knew the counts wouldn't tell us anything. I guess what you're really asking is, how certain are we that we only took the number of antlerless that we did, and that's based on a survey, and we know, really, we got good numbers on what percentage of those that had permits harvested a cow elk. So I don't think that's an issue. That's pretty solid stuff. You know, we know exactly who, and you had to let them know.
Sure. Do we know where those elk are? Where they are going to? That's I guess that's my concern. And I've talked to Craig extensively about it, and I know that you guys have a really good idea what's going on there. My biggest concern is, do we know where those animals were killing in Diamond Fork and, you know, above Springville and things like that? Where are they returning to? Are they returning to private lands? Are they returning to Strawberry Valley?
We did a study in the 90s, put radio collars on elk, and then also a little later than that, Randall Thacker in the northeastern region put collars out towards the Kern Creek unit, and those are elk that were around Heber Mountain in that area. And so we got a pretty good handle of where the elk go. Basically, when the first bullet's fired, the elk start to move to their winter range, and anything that's on this side of Strawberry Ridge move into Diamond Fork, Wallsburg, above Springville here, and then they go back up towards Strawberry Ridge. And then elk that are east of Strawberry Ridge, they migrate to the east and split. Some of them go towards Emma Park and down towards Price, and the rest of them go to the Aviniquin. There's about, of that herd, about 25% of them head to the east. And there are elk that traveled from Strawberry Ridge to Desolation Canyon on the Green River, which is 75 air miles, and then returned to the exact same place to have their calves the next year, and the consequence years after that.
Is that an anomaly, or do we have crossover from unit to unit? So are we killing a bunch of manti elk on the Wasatch and vice versa? Or
the collars we had on, we had one elk that crossed Highway 40, And that was it. We had
like
no elk that crossed onto the Manti. All the elk were going east and west. And then when Randall ran his study, he had one elk that crossed Highway 40 and wintered one year on the Wallsburg management area. Other than that, they did not cross the highways.
Okay, that answers. Thank you.
I guess the old adage that you can't herd cats also applies to elk. And the elk sometimes make it difficult to manage them. Mike.
My name's Mike Christensen. This is might be a crazy idea. It's probably not the first one you've heard from me. Probably won't be the last. But what if we took... You have the Wasatch unit is three separate subunits combined into one. You have the Vinaquin, the Wet, Wasatch West, and the Current Creek. If we took 20% of the antlerless tags from each of those units and made them a private land only tag, so 20% of the permits would go on to a private, would only be able to be used on private lands. And you know, we've done it in the past where, you know, right there in the proclamation, it says, you know, private lands must obtain permission before you, you know, apply, or, you know, it's encouraged to do that. And I think what that'll do is that would put some of that pressure on. I know we can do it through depredation hunts and some of that, but there's so many landowners out there that don't know anything about that, that I think that would, you're talking, there's 4,000 total tags, so you're talking 800 tags divided up in those three units, so less than 300 tags a unit. And just, if you made those private land only tags with some kind of liberal season, you'd kill those elk that aren't accessible to the general public, and you'd alleviate some of the pressure off the public lands. Thanks.
Thank you. Other comments?
There is one antlerless hunt of sorts.
Tell us who you are.
There was not Mike Anderson.
Thanks.
United Wildlife Cooperative. There's one hunt that didn't get included in the presentation that I think would probably be a good idea to think about a little bit, and that has to do with the Wasatch Extended Archery Deer Hunt, which includes the possibility of harvesting a doe. And since harvesting does is giving so many people such heartburn these days, and given that it really isn't a substantial loss to anyone, I think, to take away those last 2 weeks of the extended doe-only hunt and simply do away with that, I think it would make a lot of people happy. It would calm a lot of ruffled feathers over the idea of, you know, why are bow hunters up there on the Wasatch Front killing all these does? You know, let's just discontinue that hunt and the extended hunt on November 30th. Thanks.
Thank you, Mike. Anish, you want to comment on that? I think it has to do with if the hunter doesn't kill them, DWR staff gets to kill them, right?
Well, it's not only that. The harvest on that is so minuscule that it makes no difference. I mean, do it or not, it's an opportunity. If a first-time bow hunter goes up and shoots a doe, you know, more power to them. I think we're harvest at the most we've ever harvested is around 50 does on that whole unit, and on average it's like 17 does get harvested. So it's not a population control measure. More does get hit by vehicles on that in that area than get killed by hunters. So I guess to me I would rather keep the hunt because it gives archers an opportunity to harvest a doe. So what, takes a meat home, especially, you know, some young archer that is just out there to harvest his first animal or whatever. But I guess to us it doesn't make that much difference. It's more of an opportunity hunt, and not that many does get killed that it's a population control measure.
Thank you. Kim, did you have a comment? Oh.
I'd just like to address the cow problem that you have. I guess where I'm getting it is that you've got so many cows and you can't harvest them quick enough in a lot of the areas. Is that right? That kind of the problem in a lot of the areas. So I own quite a bit of private ground down in southern Utah, and I get into a lot of this stuff all the time. But, you know, I stood up here in a RAC meeting about 20 years ago and went over this very, you had the very same problem 20 years ago. The problem is, the way I see it as an avid hunter, is that you got to make it more convenient for those that are killing the elk, not convenient for the elk. Yeah, in other words, what I'm saying here, you got people that'll buy one of those cow tags. He might be 75 years old. Maybe he's got gout, can't walk very good. You got some young girl. You got all kinds of different types of people that are buying these tags. You got to make it convenient for these people to pack one of these big critters out. So I would say if you want to reach a harvest objective a little bit better, a lot of times when I'm out hunting deer, or if there are families out hunting deer, they see an elk or they see a cow elk, they could have shot it, but it's not the season. But they've got the tag, but it's not open. I'm just saying that maybe give them 4 months to harvest that elk, that cow elk in those areas when they got all their family there. I've got like four of my boys there to help pack this cow elk out. There's four cows standing there on the ridge opening morning of the deer hunt. I've got it. I can take it. I got my whole family to help me pack it out. It's convenient instead of January 1st and it's 10 below zero and 4 feet of snow on the road that I can't get in to go hunt those elk. So I just throw that tag in the garbage can and you're not getting the elk objectives that you want. So all I'm saying here is simplify it, make it easy for those that hunt them to be able to kill them when they can. And then you'll reach your objectives by probably another 50%.
Thank you.
One of you guys got to talk to them.
I think
if you don't, I will.
So we do have the type of permit he suggested on units where we have a hard time managing populations. We don't have them on the Wasatch. Obviously, if you do that, you will over-harvest. We've seen that before on other units. So we're trying to strike a balance, try to kill enough elk, but not to kill too many. If you open up the floodgates, obviously you could kill too many. And not only that, you will likely move animals to other units because elk are very easy to pack up and move. They're not as traditional as some other big game species. So it would look like that unit is, you've killed all the elk when you may have moved them. So there's a lot of things we try to do. We do have long seasons when we need to. Often when we have long seasons, people wait till it snows. So they often wait till the end of the season to do it, and sometimes they're not successful. So we've tried all these things. We've had long seasons, we've had short seasons. We kind of know what works on certain things. Obviously, elk populations, are over objective in some areas. Some of that is because successes vary from year to year, and we try to issue more and more permits wherever we can. If we feel that a longer season would work, we would do it.
And again, just as a reminder, in those five units, you can, if you have an open bull tag, you can harvest two animals. You can harvest a bull and a cow, or you can harvest two cows in those five units. This is the first time that you've been able to do that.
Well, if you have a bull tag, you can harvest only a bull and a cow. If you have an antlerless tag, you can you buy one of these, you can harvest two antlerless tags.
Yeah, John.
Yeah, just real quick. I was surprised at the number of people that came through check stations and were not aware that if they had a buck deer tag and they had a cow elk tag for the same area, that they could take their cow during the deer hunt. And it didn't matter if that cow elk was before, or the timing wasn't even an issue. So I think we need to do a better job. And it's also any bull or spike bull. If you got a permit for those and you have a cow elk in the same area, you can take the cow. It's relatively new, and a lot of people aren't aware of that, and I think that's one of the things that you were requesting us to consider, which is already provided for. So pass the word. Okay.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the comment period time, seeing no other comments, and we'll bring it back to the rack for your deliberation and motions on the antlerless permit recommendations for 2012. Richard. Tim.
Chris.
Oh. It is getting late.
You got to turn in your books.
I had a couple of questions. Mike had mentioned the private lands only Wasatch Elk cow hunt. Denise, could you speak to that and kind of give us your thoughts on that?
So unless we get the buy-in of the of those private landowners, it would do no good to have private lands only permits. So that's something we could work towards, but oftentimes we've tried. I mean, we have units that's even harder to kill elk than the Wasatch. The Wasatch is pretty easy. You put the tags out there, you get the right conditions, you'll kill elk. We've got units that are primarily private lands where we cannot get anyone on private lands, and we've worked with the private landowners. They have permits. They can buy permits over the counter and all these other things. So there's a lot of mechanisms out there. We have some private lands hunts only, but if you can't get access to private land, most private landowners, when they have elk on them that are using it as a refuge, usually it's because they're not allowing hunters on there. So, I mean, the tags are there. If they wanted the elk gone, they could just say, hey, come hunt on my place. That's not the case. So it would be something that would take a lot of, coordination to make sure we get the right people involved and they're willing to accept the public hunter on there. It may require, and we have some of these hunts out there, so we require the hunters to make sure they have access before they apply and all these other things, and we often have a lot of permits go unsold. The 9 Mile Range Creek is an example of that. It's a primary private land unit. We issue a ton of tags. A lot of them go over the counter, and often they wait until we get a storm that pushes them into the little bit of public land that's there. So, yeah, I mean, it's something we certainly always struggle with, and we have tried it. It's just trying to get the landowners to be willing to take hunters. That's the hard part.
Okay, and then thanks for that. Now, one other question, Denise, before you sit down. can you, so in today's world, on the Wasatch Front Extended, you can hunt either sex from middle of August till November 30th, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was the purpose for the extra 2 weeks doe-only hunt? Why was that set up?
So it was basically to try to harvest a few does to keep them from getting hit by vehicles, basically. But we didn't find that to be very useful, to be honest, as far as it's not really reducing the number of does. We decided not to take it out either just because it's an opportunity to harvest a doe or two. I mean, a lot of these does are getting hit by vehicles when they get into the neighborhoods and run around and stuff like that.
You don't think the 2 weeks in December is helping that situation?
The what?
The extra 2 weeks.
No, I don't believe so. It's just that there's two types of hunters there. There's those that, will go out, and most of our Wasatch Front hunters are looking for a big buck. Mm-hmm. And then you've got some youth or maybe some hunters that just want to put meat in the freezer that'll go out, and there's very few of those that do that. So, it certainly hasn't proven, and it's been in place for a long time. It hasn't proven to be a limiting factor for population growth.
Thanks, Anise.
Gary, would you like to make a motion? That's one way to do it.
Tom's a biologist for that unit, and that is included in a unit. It's just not huntable, and Tom's been working with the city to try to see if we can't work something out there.
Yeah, but Saratoga Springs is going to be a challenge. Yeah, well, the people urbanized it by putting all those developments. The other part is those Saratoga Springs and Eagle Mountain both extended their city limits. They annexed a lot of ground that's not developed, and we used to be able to hunt it, especially Eagle Mountain. The city limits goes clear down into the sod farms, and so they've cut off all hunting within city limits, even bow hunting. And so we've had a few guys get arrested for hunting in those places they used to traditionally hunt in, and so we have a little issue. In Saratoga Springs, we have an island in the middle of, and the antelope have found that. They haven't left. They haven't left the area, and that's what we're hoping to try to find them. We're going to fly actually on Thursday to find out where they're at as part of our antelope flights this year. And if they are outside the housing, then I'd like to go in and try to spook them into places we can go. But
they started at Hush Valley,
There's 10 in the Snake Valley
River,
unit.
River.
Which unit would be the?
It would be the Rush Valley unit.
Rush Valley.
I believe there's 18.
Yeah, West
15.
Desert.
West Desert is compromises so, 19 A, B, and C. Well, the problem is the outside the city limit areas are holding steady, if not declining. And if you have a doe hunt, they're going to be killing the antelope that are doing okay. They're not causing any problems. It's the small group that's within the city limits that we can't access right now. And if you have a doe hunt, they're going to kill the good deer or the good does, good antelope, and still leave and even push more antelope into the city. So we're into a challenge here.
Somebody back here trying to get in.
And we're hoping that we can catch them in the right place at the right time. But I agree. We have antelope in Salt Lake City and down in South Jordan. And well, some of the problems we had during the drought that has moved antelope, like you said, there's a couple of things. There's some drought problems. We had some fires in Rush Valley. And there's not as much. We have some guzzlers that we have to do some repair work on. But in all, we have more ATV recreation and a lot more trails going right through the antelope habitat, and I think some of that disturbance has caused some of that shift from Rush Valley into Cedar Valley. And then to control permit numbers, instead of opening up a public antlerless hunt on mostly private ground, we've been giving landowners mitigation tags to deal with antelope in the alfalfa fields and sod farms and things like that. So we've been controlling population numbers under, you know, satisfactorily talking to those landowners. We let them control the permit numbers, not the permit numbers, but the population within that private land sector, mostly the valley, and they jump into the other valley, which I don't know if we could control that or not, but that's kind of how it progressed. But we do give the landowners in Cedar Valley, especially in the depredation situations, mitigation tags to deal with that, and it's controlled the numbers fairly well. Can't do that now as well in Saratoga Springs and Eagle Mountain, especially down by the sod farms, because of the city limits go way beyond where the housing is. So we're going to try to work with those cities to try to come up with some sort of a way to have an archery hunt or some way to deal with those.
I see another 80 deer that won't be an animal tag.
Well, I've been given problem. I've been given antelope tags for problems. Not city limits, because they'll get arrested. And, you know, you can't beat them off. So that it's a situation that's kind of a sticky one that, you know, we've got to think outside the box and maybe get agreements with the cities to work with that. And they have, and that's why I didn't want to end up with a lot of conflicts with private landowners and public hunters. And so to control population numbers, we've been using mitigation tags to do that. And it's worked fairly well, you know, dealing with some of the bigger landowners that are in. If you've got land that's having, you know, depredation issues, absolutely. You know, but that jump into Saratoga Springs and now that west side of Eagle Mountain is going to be a stickler. Well, we'll see if you qualify. So. But that's kind of the roundabout picture of what's going on there. We're hoping that we get some response from the city to deal with some of that. Yeah, absolutely. And if we were to try to go in there and move those animals, you can't outrun them. And if they cross the highway and get hit, then we've got issues. So right now it's kind of, if we catch them in the right place, we can maybe push them. But it's not an easy thing to try to do.
Sarah, can you help me out? I'm looking for a motion here.
I have a question.
Oh, George.
You're talking about depredation and for mitigation. Are there time limits on that, or is there particular times of the year for pronghorn, for example?
Well, we try to do it when there is damage occurring. If the animals are not doing much damage, it really doesn't.
How do you tell? What's much damage?
Time of year is the next thing. If you're, you know, in August.
Okay. Now? Now?
Now? Yeah, if they're stunning the growth or dealing with that, and it's
or
a problem
there or
for
needy.
You,
okay.
Consider it.
I have a.
But the permits.
Okay.
Permits can only be starting August.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean.
So they cannot be shot until August.
That's correct. So we look at what the damage is happening now. We could probably pay you until July 1st, fiscal year, and then we'll start looking at another. And then August, if they're in there, we'll deal with them.
Okay, and I'm sorry, but I'm going to editorialize here a little bit. Christopher, I know it sounds like a good idea to give tags to private landowners, but one of the problems in Heber Valley is a lot of the private landowners don't want people hunting there, and the elk don't stay there. They move. I also probably agree that the count on the elk is off. Ty, I listened to you for a lot, so I want you to listen to me. I think the count on the elk is off, but I think it's off the other way, because I think there's more elk than really the count, because it was estimated you counted 85%. If the estimate would have been 70%, then the number would have been a lot higher. I'm done, and I'll make a motion. I move we accept the recommendation or pass on the recommendation of the DWR on this.
Antlerless permits. Is there a second? Second by Tim. All in favor? Opposed? It passes unanimously. And I, George, I appreciate your comments, and I appreciated this discussion, because for those of you who hung around tonight, you can begin to appreciate some of the problems that we do have in trying to manage wildlife in Utah. And Heber Valley is a perfect example of everybody kind of knows what the problem is, but the solutions are really hard to come by. And so I think the discussion is well received, because we know that it's not always an easy answer. Craig, you're up.
Uh,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I do appreciate the opportunity to present to you, and I appreciate all of your guys' hard work as well. I will be presenting the 2012 CWMU Antlerness Recommendations for the state.
You know, people have to realize
what everything is. Just to clarify here real quickly, voucher are permits that we give to the landowner that they can sell, and then those vouchers are brought into the division office, and we can give those out, or they can declare who they want to have those vouchers, and we can get those permits to them. So those permits are the private permits. The other permits mentioned there are the ones that the public get. This program is on a three-year basis now. They receive a COR, which is a certificate of registration, and it is for 3 years. There's 14 CWMU CORs previously approved by the board that include the vouchers and the permits. As you can see, there's 50 vouchers and 197 permits. There's another 48 CWMU that require the board's approval for that three-year COR. And that those vouchers are broken down as you see there. So there's a total of 62 total CWMUs that are requesting permits for 2012, or a total of 1,646. Now, the biologists have done a great job in working with the landowners, with the operators, and coming to an agreement with them, so there's really no controversy with these recommendations. Two of the CWMUs are requesting that we do not have any antlerless moose permits this year. They have had them in the past. The Stillman Creek and Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, I believe both of those are in the northern region. And the way that the system works is that it is set by the number of bucks and bulls options. So if a CWMU picks a bucks and bull option of having 90% go to the private sector then and 10% to the public, then that automatically sets the antlerless permit options. And these are set by code, can't be changed. There's actually four different scenarios that the operator can pick. If they pick the 90-10 split, then automatically they on the antlerless permits, they get zero for themselves and 100% go to the public. This center column represents the number of CWMUs that have picked the different scenarios. So for instance, in that one, there's 32 CWMUs that have picked that option of a 90-10 split. If they were to pick a 75-25 split, meaning that the public get 25%, a few more, of the permits, then more of the permits on the antlerless would go to the CWMU system, and then it would be a 50-50 split. And you can see from the center column that most of them pick that 90-10 because that gives them the more bull tags or more buck tags, which are the higher priced item. Then also on the pronghorn and as well as the moose, they only have one option, and that's the 60-40 split. And then for the antlerless, it's just flip-flopped. They would receive 40% of the antlerless, and the public would receive 60%. There are no moose this year, of course, so there's seven units within for pronghorn. Just as an overview of the 2011, we had 10 public doe tags, and it was a two doe permit to allow for less hunters but still be able to take the number of animals that they wanted to take. And then, of course, the numbers of elk, pronghorn, and moose are there, totaling the 1,566 total permits. For 2012, the total is, as I mentioned earlier, 1,646 total. The public would be getting 1,258 of those, while the CWMUs would be taking 388 total permits. And the breakdown, of course, is there again. And there's also, again, DOE permits on one unit in the northern region. And that's it.
Thank you, Craig. No antlerless moose permits on CWMUs?
No.
Okay, questions from the RAC? Again, not to prolong, but there's similar issues with CWMUs in terms of trying to get antlerless elk killed, and that continues to be an ongoing problem, but we do our best and we work with them. Questions from the audience? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the RAC for your deliberation and motion. Larry. Motion from Larry to accept the recommendations as presented. A second. A second from Chris. Further discussion? All in favor? And that passes unanimously. You, just to be contrary?
No, because I think that we should not give them 90-10. I think that split ought to go to 80-20.
Okay.
We should increase the public government. They'll still participate in getting so much money for us. Elk tagged already, and I'm a private corporate landowner.
Duly noted. Okay, our last action item. And Alan, thank you for being with us all evening.
Good.
It's been fun.
I haven't been back to visit with you for a little while. This will be really brief to go through and can talk about. Answer questions probably is an easier thing to do with it. So let me just go through the presentation really quick. Greg Sheehan and I have kind of shared over the last 15 years the bonus point, reference point issues and things that have come up. So we were both involved when the idea of dropping bonus points for people who hadn't applied came up, and now we're sharing the thing to go back and say that wasn't a really good idea. And so that's basically what this is about tonight.
Oops, wrong thing. Let's try that one. All right.
Don't hit end show.
I can do it the hard way. I'm good. I'm old enough. So what we did is, back in 2008, the Wildlife Board was looking for ways to make it easier to draw permits for everybody. There was a lot of, we were increasing permits, but not increasing as much as we were getting applicants. And so the board looked at a whole bunch of options. We actually went through an informational meeting, and then we went through a round of RACs and had a list of probably a dozen different ideas to go out to the RACs and the board to look at ways to make the drawing easier. The bottom line is there's only one way to make the drawing easier. You either have fewer people applying or you have more permits. That's all, you either make the pie bigger or you make the number of pieces you cut it into different. So that's kind of where it was, but the board had a big interest in that. And so we explored a whole bunch of different ideas, and this was one idea that came up that we adopted, that the board actually adopted after through the REC process, that if somebody goes 3 consecutive years without applying for a big game, limit entry or once a lifetime permit or a bonus point, they lose all of their points. So they go back to zero. And so there were a couple assumptions that we made when we did that. The original intent was, first of all, to clean up our records by removing non-participants. So we had that as an idea, that we would eliminate those who aren't contributing annually to wildlife management in Utah. That was a second idea behind that. And the third one was to, as I mentioned, reduce competition, improve the odds to draw these hard-to-get permits. What we discovered is that most of those assumptions were wrong. First of all, it didn't actually improve the odds. It had no effect on the odds, because if they're not applying, they aren't competing against you anyway. And so we ran into that issue. The second thing, the idea of eliminating those that are not contributing annually, we have something on the order, we see the number down there, about 95,000 people that have at least one bonus point or sitting out there. But when we went and did an analysis, we found out a third of those people were buying a hunting license or a fishing license every year. So they are contributing. They just don't choose to apply in the draw. And so the question is, why would we take away their points if they are still contributing to wildlife management in Utah? So that's an issue that we ran into. The other thing about cleaning up the records by removing non-participants is all of you know with the where technology's gone with databases and that, they don't really plug up the works anymore. It doesn't really hurt the system to maintain that. We did run into some additional problems because this is the year we would have to eliminate them. So the board gave us a one-year grace to figure out how to do this, and so 2012 is the year that we would have to put them out. A couple things are different. There's some legal implications in that how do you give adequate notice? Some of the people have changed addresses. We can't contact them. How do we contact 95,000 people and say, if you don't do this, you're going to do it? Now, we put it on our website, but if they're not applying in our drawing, why would they see it on the application? You know, if you think. So we have some concerns that there's some legal implications. I already mentioned many non-participants are still active. They're still out there. The odds didn't improve. We talked about that. The other thing is there's going to be huge administrative costs. If we send out a letter to each of these people on the address that's there, it's going to cost us at least $70,000 this year to do it. So instead of saving money, it's going to cost us money to do that. You can see the hunters affected. There's 95,000. And the other thing that we're worried about is some of these individuals applied once as a teenager, young person, while they're in their home, they're out. Now they decide to get back in hunting, and they go to apply in a drawing after 4, 5, or 6 years, and we have this big recruitment effort, and they find out we took their points away from them between, you know, when they applied as a youth in the home and so on. So for all of those reasons, we're recommending that forfeiture section be rescinded in the rule. And so we think it makes sense. Sometimes we try things like anybody in government or private industry. You try something and you figure out it doesn't do what you want to do. It actually has the opposite effect. And I think that's what we believe this has done. So be glad to answer any questions if you have them, but that's kind of the bottom.
Thank you, Ellen. I think Robert Burns said it best. The best laid schemes of mice and men gang after glay.
Yep.
Questions from the rack? Questions from the audience? He just wants you to make you feel good, Alan, that you came all the way down here.
Steve Jones from West Jordan. One of the things I thought about was, of that 95,000 people that are not putting in permits, what is the breakdown of points that they have? Do we have a bunch in there that have 4 or 5 points or 5 or 6, you know?
We have people all the way up with 18 points that haven't applied for 3 years. And so you picture somebody. Now, why they're not, we don't know all the reasons.
Well, but what I'm...
But most of them are ones. Most of them are ones and twos.
Yeah, and the ones or twos are not going to, I agree, they're not going to have an effect on when they come back into the pool. But if there's a 10,000 of them have 4 permits or 5 permits, when they come back, if they come into the pool in a lump, in other words, all of a sudden our herds take off and everybody goes ooh ah, and they jump back in, they are going to jump in front of the people that have been back here, you know, trying to, you know, maybe they didn't go through the first time or not. So
yeah, they won't jump. They won't jump in front if you've been doing a few years. But you're right; they could come back in. Probably that split that we did when we found out, are they buying any other wildlife document in the last 3 years when we ran that analysis? Probably 2/3 of them will never hear from again. They're probably gone forever for whatever reason it is. Some cases an individual has died. In some cases they've moved. A lot of reasons, life changes and so on. But there's a third of them who are still there, and the question is, if you take their points away, when they paid the same application and bought the same hunting license that the rest of us do that are in the drawing, do they have some kind of right to those points? Do we have a right to take them away? And that's our concern. That's the legal implication.
Well, I struggle with that because they've been given notice way up front that this is the way the system was going to work. There's no rocket science there.
Yeah.
Even a slow person can understand that. But I, as a person that's been continually putting into the system, and yeah, maybe I'm lucky enough to get a permit, and now I'm gone to the back of the line, that person may come in front. Has he paid his dues? In some ways, yes. In some ways, no.
Exactly.
So I don't, from a legal standpoint, I just find it They've been given notice. It's the same as what the banks do and whatnot. Your time runs out, your time runs out.
And I understand, but like I said, that I understand exactly what you're saying. Being on a waiting period for elk, I know what you're talking about.
Brad, I've got something. Why don't we figure out a system where guys can buy those bonus points from those people, and you split the proceeds?
That was actually one of the proposals that we took out of something. You remember, the other thing was whether or not somebody could make a one-time gift to a family member of those. That, I mean, we took all kinds of ideas around to look at it. In the end, most of them were just ideas. We have a pretty good system. You know, I defend our system because of the way our system works is everybody, the first year you apply, you got a chance. You know, whereas in a lot of states, you don't have a chance till you've done it in a whole bunch of years. And I think that's a reward for a kid. Having a kid who applied for a while in the hunts, if I told her there's no way that you're ever going to draw, you're just doing this to earn some future opportunity, it isn't good. But yet we still give the people who have been in line the longest, they get the best chance. And so that's kind of a neat, it's a pretty neat system to, in my mind, that balances those two things.
Sarah.
Yes, sir.
Help me out with a motion here.
I would like to make a motion to accept the division's recommendation.
Thank you.
I second it.
Is there a second? I'm sorry, there's no second. Your motion dies.
Hey, that's a great motion.
Can you only second one at a meeting?
George, would you like to second her motion?
I did a long time ago.
Thank you very much.
I was flirting and missed it.
All in favor? Opposed? Thank you. Thank you, everybody who attended tonight and made comments. I appreciate it. The board meeting that will be considering these recommendations will be on May 3rd. Anybody interested in attending the board meeting? And we'll see you all back here on...
Oh, you want me to tell you that?
On?
Next month. May 15th.
And we'll be back here again on the 15th of May. Did you like it?
Yeah, other than the announcement.
Please clean up your stuff around your chairs so that we'll be invited back.
Thank you.